Is this working with this?
Me and you work together and Carl can work on his own. I bet Carl's going to... I'll tell Kyle how to do it.
This will be fine. This is pretty good. I'm just going to switch it on to silent.
Can I try?
And,
if you finish this one, can I do
it? Why are you doing this one? I thought I'd switch you off. Switch you off now. I'm just going to mess with that.
Can you put that on to see if the sound will actually come out of the...
Oh, sure, yeah.
Possibly one of the most interesting aspects of observing flying saucers beyond the realization that they are real and that
that's extraterrestrial
is their philosophy.
What kind of creatures
build and fly? How do they think? Are their ideas and ideals similar to ours? Could we understand them? All these and many other questions plague the serious investigator.
So that was Wilbert Smith talking in about 1958, that recording was made. Yeah, 1958. So, let us see.
Absolutely silent.
Like you were yesterday.
You can stay in here. But if you can't be absolutely silent, you have to go up into your room. Do you understand?
You can play quietly on your Kindle. Say
no shouting or speaking when you go to
point. Look at your own.
Yeah.
It's not started yet, has it?
No, well, I've just said we can start it. I've let it go in, but I can add it.
You!
Then you can sit and listen and learn.
I mean, it might be, I don't know, it might be a bit for them to listen to. Mightn't it? I don't know whether you find it interesting or not.
What about you do your drawing then?
Charge!
You did have some, yesterday.
No.
Well, you ask
me, Silas.
Go on, say
it. Oh, it does work.
Yeah, go on, Silas, say. Go on, say
that
you're
just moaning.
If you've got to your room, you cannot argue.
Oh.
No running down the corridors either, or yelling. If you come downstairs, you come silently down. Do you understand? I'm not going to let go of Bryn.
Is she going to be told to be quiet?
Bryn, you've got to be quiet.
Promise my quiet.
Do you like holding your cat, or do you...
Yeah, when she sits, she won't sit for long, though. I won't really hold her for long. I'll only hold her for literally half a minute. And just, I like stroke her like this, really fast.
I'll come get you and come back down again.
Mixy! Like that, and then I let her go. You know.
She made me cut my
Oh. But I usually let her go once, Once she wants to go, I let her go.
Yeah, I always let it go a little bit past that point. I'm a trapping in a chair type person. I do it to people as well.
I was beginning to get this impression, and your mum was telling me the story about you and your sister. Strapping her into a chair.
I didn't strap her, I trapped her.
Oh, wow, okay. It's this idea of confining people which is of some concern.
You just kneel on the chair with her arms on either side of the... And
oh, I see.
So it was underneath, so she couldn't get out.
Because I love her.
She traps you by lying on top of you, isn't she? Squishing you down.
understand that I need to cuddle her.
So shall I carry on? Shall I carry on then?
Yeah, let's get started. Right, Silas. He's got that thing on, and he's
going to
trap himself in it.
I don't know. Is he? Did he not
collapse? You're so precious, aren't you? Hang on, you're scratching me. Stop it.
Oh, you got scratched, and you got caught, of course. Claws caught in her top, in your top.
Boing! There you go. She doesn't want to be cuddled, she shouldn't be so
no.
cute.
thing, isn't it? Mitch is a bit like that. She is very cute. And sometimes she doesn't mind, but other times, no. Mm-hmm. No thanks. And yeah. I don't want him.
Okay, will you give me a throat? Oh. I think I'm coming down with something.
Might be because you just run down because of the late nights you've had and stuff like that. The last week and last night.
Yeah. It
doesn't
take much. You get older.
I don't think so.
It's terrible because in the end, you're and then one late night, and you're like, ooh, and actually, for the whole week since last weekend, which was hectic.
Yeah.
I felt like I'm in a bit of a dream state, really.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, pretty much since I had that fainting thing at the vet's, which is
oh, you
day
said,
that
yeah.
ghost hunt.
Yeah, I remember you saying that.
Yeah, I just literally keeled over, didn't I? Mum was there. I just went right back.
Like, oh, gosh. You keeled over.
Mm-hmm. I came so, round, and then they sat me in a chair, and then I fainted again, didn't I? I didn't even see blood the second time. Terrible. Really squeamish.
It took her ages before she could understand what we were saying to her.
It's awful. Because all the blood had gone from my head. It's all gone into my body. Because it's that
grey
preservation thing, you know, where it all goes out of your legs and your arms and your head. All the blood goes to your vital organs. And I did it in front of you and I just cut my leg shaving. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Andrew, get going.
Okay.
Get talking.
So I wanted to put in this that about Wilbert Smith and his key role in the research and analysis of the flying saucer phenomenon, because when he was looking at this, it wasn't called UFOs. And the reason why I was interested in Smith was because he had a lot of significant things to tell us, I think. He doesn't seem to be that well known. You don't hear a lot of people talking about him. Stanton Friedman's mentioned him a bit. All of this stuff has come from Grant Cameron, as I'll say later on, Canadian researcher. He was a fairly prominent member of the Canadian government, and he had access to classified information, which is how he became sort of more well known in the UFO culture, if you will. He had an unusual combination of views, which seemed to be at odds with his scientific work and his other work, as well, and you're going to come across other figures who either worked with Smith, gave him information, or were speaking out during the same time period, such as George Adamski, for example, in that sort of time frame, although I don't think he ever met George Adamski. We're also going to look at some of the other disclosure issues relating to UFO and ET stuff, such as McDonnell Douglas aircraft documents, which were leaked to us in 2005, and I did mention in this presentation Travis Walton's case as well, because this is the first half is basically Wilbert Smith, second half is more disclosure, and then I put the Wilbert Smith thing right at the end, which I made a little video of, and I also put into this some of the Mexico footage from 2009 as well. And Wilbert Smith checked the evidence. A bit about his life. He was born in Lethbridge, Alberta, Canada in 1910, graduated from the University of British Columbia in 1933 with a BSc in electrical engineering. He obtained a master's degree in 1934, also at University of British Columbia, and in 1934 and 35 he became chief engineer for the radio station CJOR in Vancouver. And in the years following that, at certain times, he acted as a consultant to the government. And in 1939, he joined the Federal Department of Transport, because the communications for Canada came within the Department of Transport at that time. He was engaged in the engineering of Canada's wartime radio monitoring service. So they set up all these, you know, network of aerials and receivers to pick up the various communications which they wanted to monitor. Smith was involved in that. 1947, he was in charge of establishing a network of ionospheric measurement stations, several of which were in isolated parts of northern Canada. He eventually became superintendent of radio regulations engineering within the Department of Transport, again, all in Canada. His research was into radio wave propagation, which is how radio waves travel through the atmosphere and can be affected by, you know, land, atmospheric conditions and so forth. And he came across such topics as auroras, cosmic radiation, atmospheric radioactivity and geomagnetism. That's looking at the Earth's magnetic field, because that's all related to radio wave phenomena. And that's where he got interested in the source of phenomenon, because of, you know, things like effects on radio, magnetic fields, those sorts of things. And he continued to work for the Department of Transport until his death in 1962. And he died of cancer of the lower bowel in that year. And at the time of his death, he held 37 patents. So he was a clever guy. And he was married to Merle, and they had three children, James, Dick and Norma Ray. And you'll hear James, I've got a little audio of James Smith, because he has spoken about what his father told him when he was 19 years old. So Smith's interest in flying saucers started when he became curious after reading an article in a magazine in the late 1940s. And though he started out as a strong sceptic, he pursued this interest in his own time strongly and systematically. He was an engineer, you know, so he's used to breaking things down, problem solving, all that sort of stuff. He almost always referred to them as flying saucers and very rarely as UFOs, because that was a term coined by Edward J. Ruppelt in 1952. And the point was that they were unidentified. So, you know, you couldn't say what they were. So that was, you know, you couldn't call it a flying saucer. And I just put in some pictures there of some of Smith's contemporaries. Frank Edwards, he was a sort of a little bit like the George Noory of his day, you know, the sort of coast-to-coast host he used to do programs like that. But he was a journalist. Major Donald Kehoe, who was in the Air Force, in the US Air Force. And Kenneth Arnold, who was the guy who had the sighting of the object. Oh, I should have a picture of Betty and Barney Hill there, but I don't seem to have. That hasn't come up for some reason. I don't know why. I don't know why those pictures haven't come up. That's strange. They were there, and they've disappeared. But Betty and Barney Hill, was that he knew of them. He got to know of them. Sorry? They were abducted in 1961. Yes, they abducted from here, I think, maybe, yes. So the reason why Smith became well known in the UFO community was because of this document, the top secret memo. It was written in November 1950 by Smith, and it was researcher Nick Blaskus discovered a copy of this memo in the University of Ottawa archives, of all places, and it was declassified by the Canadian government in 1979. And this is a copy, I think it was a 3 or 4 page memo, and he said, I made discreet inquiries. This is about the flying saucer phenomenon. This is 1950, remember, so we're now 65 years ago. Through the Canadian embassy staff in Washington, who were able to obtain for me the following information. The matter is the most highly classified subject in the United States government, rating higher even than the H-bomb. Flying saucers exist. Their modus operandi is unknown, but concentrated effort is being made by a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush. The entire matter is considered by the United States authorities to be of tremendous significance. Okay, and then further to that, I was further informed that the United States authorities are investigating along quite a number of lines which might possibly be related to the sources, such as mental phenomena. and I gather that they are not doing too well since they indicated that if Canada is doing anything at all in geomagnetics, they would welcome a discussion with suitably accredited Canadians. So they were looking for help at that time, according to this memo. But mental phenomena. Smith was talking about the relationship between flying saucers and mental phenomena 65 years ago. The top secret memo, people like Stan Friedman, they did a bit of research into this when they found out about it in the 70s or 80s. In fact, this was in 1983, so even this telephone call, which I've just edited together, because it's about 20 minutes long, the whole thing, if you listen to it, I've got the complete recording. And this all came from Grant Cameron. The information about the classification of the UFO subject appears to have been given to Smith by Robert Sarbacher, and he confirmed this in a 1983 telephone interview with the UFO researcher and investigator, nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman. So I'll just play this clip, which is just about a minute long. So what Sarbacher was saying was that he did give the information to Smith. He confirmed that he gave him the information about the classification rating. And then Stanton Friedman wondered if that was to do with some of the crashes, the UFO crashes. But Sarbacher said he didn't know about that, but he'd heard rumours of it. That's what he basically says in that conversation. But that whole thing is about 20 minutes long if you listen to the whole thing. But that's just to confirm that we do know where Smith got some of his information from for that memo. Some of it came from Sarbacher. Grant Cameron did a whole lot of research into Sarbacher and his background and where he got that information. But it wasn't clear who gave Smith the information about the mental phenomena. Sarbacher didn't even give him that information. And that little bit where he's saying, you know, it's the operation of the sources is related to mental phenomena, that bit of information came from somebody else. I don't think they found out who gave him that information, but it wasn't Sarbacher. But Smith left the memo draft in his files to give future researchers the truth of what had actually happened in the early days of government investigation into flying saucers. And dying of cancer, Smith made arrangement with his wife to hide the files so that they would survive his death. And Smith said they will be coming to recover them, he told his wife. As predicted, Canadians, Americans and the Soviets approached Mrs. Smith, requesting the files for research purposes. Mrs. Smith told all callers she no longer had the files, and after a number of break-ins that might have been linked to the search for the files were passed on to Arthur Bray, an Ottawa researcher who held them quietly for over 20 years, till the mid-70s, and that's when Grant got on the case, and Nick Belaskis, they were taking up the case then. And I think Grant Cameron, who still lives in Winnipeg, he's got most of those files now, and he's got a proportion of them. Because Arthur Bray, I think, has since passed on. So Project Magnet, this is, again, you'll hear Smith's name in connection with this. What was Project Magnet? Well, in that memo, he recommends that the Canadian government, because remember he's writing this memo to the Canadian government, he writes to them and recommends that a project be set up within the framework of this section, in other words, Smith's section, to study this problem, i.e. the flying saucer problem, and that the work be carried on a part-time basis until such time as sufficient tangible results can be seen to warrant more definitive action. cost of the program in its initial stages are expected to be less than a few hundred dollars and can be carried out by our radio standards lab appropriation. So though officially Smith's flying saucer interest was private, in reality he used his knowledge and government position to instigate a research project known as Project Magnet, as shown in the memo, to study aspects of the saucer phenomenon. That was his goal. So he knew he had some resources at his disposal, and he thought, right, I'm going to use these because this needs to be looked at properly. That's what he did. Smith was therefore proposing to set up a semi-official study of the saucer phenomenon. The proposal was accepted and a station was set up at Shirley Bay, about 20 miles outside Ottawa. Don't know, is it? That's right. Can do this slide again. Somebody in a high-vis jacket. Yeah. Unless they're asking for money. Oh, it's an Amazon. Oh, it's an Amazon. Dun, dun, dun. That's all right.
What is it?
Weird stuff coming on Sunday. Yeah, it does
though
from Amazon.
Does, yeah. We've had deliveries on Sunday from Amazon. Surprising deliveries.
Cleanser and toothpaste.
Oh.
Is that stuff I was telling you about?
I thought. What? Tell me about again.
September. October.
Oh. What's it called? What's it?
It's natural, peppermint free. It's not got any.
It's got chloride. Banana seed, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's lovely. Yeah, it's like banana seeds flavour.
Excellent.
It keeps your teeth pretty good, actually.
I've used some other stuff called Allodent, which has got aloe vera in it.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to watch out for that brand, because some of it does have fluoride in it. There's stuff with fluoride and some without.
Do you get it without? Yeah.
Because it's fluoride-free.
Do they put fluoride in
free
the water here?
Like where we are, I don't think they put fluoride in the water where we are.
You do get small amounts of natural fluoridation from the...
Right. There's fluoride in tea.
Table, right?
Yeah.
But in America they put it in. Just do put it in, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah. Some places here do as well. So, you know, it does vary.
Mm.
I've just put something on my website because Wakefield's County Council wanted to do it. And the chap, that chap I was speaking to at ExoPolitics that I mentioned, he's written to Wakefield County Council to tell them to not do it. And he wrote this big long report. About 50 pages long.
And what's their reason behind doing it?
Well, they claim that it improves dental health, don't they? That's basically it.
But you know what? If someone's looking after their teeth, they shouldn't be putting... You know,
that's right, you shouldn't be forced dental health medication.
No.
Because it's forced medication.
It is.
You know, whatever way you look at it.
It is. And people aren't like, you know, pets. If their teeth are going to fall apart, they're not looking after them. You can't poison the water just because some people don't know how to look after their teeth.
Exactly. So the whole argument, you can tell, doesn't stack up just from that.
It's nonsense, isn't it?
That's all right. That's right, that's right. It's just a purely nonsense argument.
It keeps your teeth free of plaque.
Yeah.
Used regularly, it says, which it does. It makes them feel very clean,
isn't
it?
Mm.
Yeah, it's got to...
You should get some.
Yeah, no, well, I'll probably try that brand. Y Leader.
Yeah.
Made in Germany.
Okay.
About £3.
Helen's been using it for years now, hasn't she?
Yeah.
We always used to get...
We've been using it on and off for years, but we've literally stopped together. This is a... You can get this on Amazon where you get as however many a month. It's cheaper to get...
Subscribe
and save.
So you subscribe to it and get three tubes delivered every month.
And you don't run out. You don't
just enough to keep us all going.
If you run out, what have you got on offer in the shops? Not much. Apart from
no, you don't get much of it. No.
Nonsense.
That's right. You don't get much in the shops. I don't think there's any in the supermarkets. There's no fluoride in that I've seen. I have looked, and I don't think there's any fluoride free.
Bleach.
Bicarbonate of soda is meant to be better than anything else, isn't it?
What people used to use a twig and bicarb.
Yeah. okay. Well, I'll carry on with this slide. Smith was therefore proposing to set up a semi-official study of the saucer phenomena. The proposal was accepted and a station was set up at Shirley Bay, about 20 miles outside Ottawa. This was the Department of Transport's communications monitoring facility, and the area was later used by the Department of Defence, so it was one of these, you know, sort of government areas. And here's some pictures that Grant had got. Obviously, the one on the left is more modern. I don't know what that is on the left, but this was some of the equipment that they'd set up there. And basically they were waiting for a flying saucer to be in the area, and then they were having paper chart recorders to measure the strength of the magnetic field and so forth, and various other readings that they were taking. The project ran for 3 or 4 years with the aim of gathering information about magnetic phenomena. It was meant to be classified in case the results yielded a new insight into magnetic phenomena which might be exploited. It was not actually called a saucer detection station, and its existence was only reluctantly acknowledged during Smith's later life. So they didn't really like saying that they were sponsoring this sort of thing, as you'll see in a couple of minutes. On August the 8th, 1954, at 3:01 p.m, after 8 months of watching flat lines on graph paper, the gravimeter, which was measured the force of gravity, small variations in that, began to twitch, and then it went crazy. Unfortunately, the area was completely fogged in. So in other words, they detected something at that time and date. And the observatory and Project Magnet were both shut down on August the 10th, 1954. In other words, only 2 days later. After Smith's death in 1962, the strength of denials about the project seemed to increase. I've just got a little audio clip here of Smith talking about it.
I might point out that the Project Magnet that I was associated with, and which received a great deal of publicity, was not an official government project. It was a project that I talked the deputy minister into letting me carry out, making use of the extensive field organization of the Department of Transport. No funds were spent on it, and we merely had access to the very large field organization and opened a number of files. Unfortunately, the gentleman at the press climbed on this and made a big deal out of it. As a matter of fact, some of the headlines concerning Project Magnet were set in larger type than the declaration of war. However, we carried the project through officially for about 4 years, and the last year of the four, we had a little ship set up in which we had a number of instruments, the idea being to try and coordinate sightings with scientific measurements. We had equipment for detecting any radio noise that might emanate from these objects, any gravitational disturbances which might result, any radioactivity which be connected with it, and any magnetic disturbances. These four instruments were of a recording type and produced graphical lines on a recording tape using a 4-pin recorder. This ran 24 hours a day with alarm circuits attached so that in case any of the pins moved beyond a prescribed limit, the horns would blow and the bells would ring and the boys in the
So he didn't talk about the actual event that closed it down in that audio. That might have actually been... No, that was probably recorded after this all happened. But, you know, he was then caught up in this kind of controversy over it. But there was... we spoke about this on Facebook a little bit. And I need to find out a bit more about that. There was this Project Magnet interim report, which was classified in 1953, and it wasn't declassified until 1979. And the conclusions of that interim, this is the interim report, were as follows. The final report was never released to the public. Based on strict statistical analysis, Smith's team determined that there was a 91% probability that the objects were real and a 60% probability that they are alien vehicles. Again, I'm not sure how they determined that, but that's what was apparently in this interim report. That interim report sat on the Prime Minister's desk for 3 months. At the end of the period, Prime Minister Louis St Laurent determined that the time for the release of such a report was not right, and Wilbert Smith apparently went along with the decision. In 1959, Smith wrote to a man who was attempting to get a copy of the Project Magnet final report, not the interim report. Smith wrote, "You will recall last March that I didn't think you had a proverbial snowball's chance of prying it loose. No minister in his right mind is going to release any report which in any way might prove embarrassing or give rise to questions that he or his colleagues might find difficult to answer." So in other words, it's not the sort of information they can deal with in a political framework. You know, how do you politicise the UFO issue? Well, the answer is you don't. It's just not what politicians are into. A statement prepared for the Minister of Transport to be presented to in the House of Commons, this is in Canada, of course, which has the same sort of system as we do, in the 1950s, for example, said, "The entire programme, as in Project Magnet, is being carried on with the official approval and authority to make use of existing facilities," which is what Smith himself said. Months after Smith died in late 62, Mr. Dupuy, the Minister of the Department of Transport, made his final positive statement in the House of Commons. Between December 1950 and August 1954, a small programme of investigation in the field of geomagnetics was carried out by the then Communications Division of the Department of Transport, with a view to obtaining, if possible, some physical information or facts which might help to explain the phenomena which was generally referred to as unidentified flying objects. Mr. W.B. Smith was the engineer in charge of this programme. So they said it was run in the field of geomagnetics by the then Communications Division of the Department of Transport. That was an official statement in 1962. By 1964... UFO researcher Arthur Bray received a letter that started the denial. "At no time has this department carried out research into the field of unidentified flying objects. The department did not take part in any of," that's bracket, "Smith's research work, nor did Mr. Smith provide the department with any useful information arising out of his work." By 1968, the denial was completed. The statement that would forever be provided for inquiries related to Smith was completed. The key UFO sceptic at the Dominion Observatory, Dr. Peter Millman, wrote it up. And Stanton Friedman knows more about this Peter Millman guy. I think he's spoken a bit more about the guy. "The project was a personal one carried out by Mr. Smith with the knowledge of his department, but without any official sponsorship." So they've actually changed the facts. You can see how they subtly changed the truth over time. They denied any involvement. So we then come on to the story, that's a sort of potted history of Project Magnet, which is what, again, Smith was quite well known for, the unusual story of Francis Swan, Affer and Tyler. Now, Smith came into contact with Francis Swan because he was going round looking for people who'd seen UFOs, and he was gathering witness reports and writing them all down and tabulating them and that sort of thing. That's what he was doing in the 1940s, late 40s and 50s. And Smith came into contact with Frances Swan in 1954. She was one of a number of ET contactees that Smith had corresponded with, again over the issues of sightings and contacts. This was due to Swan coming into contact with the US government regarding two mysterious satellites which orbited the Earth in 1953 and 1954, one of which reportedly came in and hovered over the Pentagon at 90,000 feet, according to reports then. So then, of course, Sputnik was the first satellite, and that went up in 1957, so this was before we should have had any satellites of our own in orbit. Swan claimed to be in contact with one of the occupants of the ship, Affer, who was commander of a ship called M4, and Ponar was the commander of L-11, and she described them as 190 miles across. So, wow, if they were that big, I mean, that's obviously huge. But some of this, again, is channeled information, which, you know, if you've looked at this stuff yourselves, you'll know is not necessarily that reliable. And it was Vice Admiral Knowles who knew Smith He lived quite close to Swan, and he asked her technical questions, I think, in relation to these satellites, which she was able to answer. This convinced Knowles that she had some genuine knowledge. In other words, certain things Swan said, because she was just an old lady, she wasn't involved with the military or anything. But Swan, they did have an FBI file on Swan. And I think here... Yeah, and when I got the archives from Grant, there's pages and pages of stuff that I think Swan had written out. I don't know who typed it, whether she did or somebody else. Swan stated that on many occasions she was in contact with Effa, this commander of this ship. And these contacts went on for several years. She tried to arrange a meeting between Smith, Effa, government officials, and an agreed location. And the documents about this were originally classified for a number of years. And Grant's got this story on his website, Grant Cameron, where they go and see Francis Swan. I think there's Admiral Knowles and there's a couple of other guys. And she's apparently talking to Effa, you know, via telepathy or whatever. And they say, well, we want proof, you know, that this guy is real. We want proof this is a real being that you're speaking to. So how are you going to prove it to us? And so the story goes, one of the stories, and there's, I think, more than one, Francis Swan says, well, if you go to the window now, you'll see Effa's craft is out there. And they went to the window and they saw, you know, a UFO right at that time. And they were amazed. So the story goes. I mean, I haven't got any pictures or anything. But Francis Swan did live quite near Betty and Barney Hill, that she only lived about a mile away, which is quite unusual. Elliott, Maine, in the US. Because that was in the US rather than in Canada. That Francis Swan, in other words, I think lived in the US, not in Canada, but Smith got to know through that.
Our guest tonight is Major Donald E. Kehoe, U.S. Marine Corps retired, a veteran of 35 years of civilian and military flying experience. Major Kehoe was aide to Colonel Charles Lindbergh on Lindy's tour of the country after the historic transatlantic flight. A well-known aviation writer, in 1950, Major Kehoe brought out his bestseller, Flying Saucers Are Real, which stirred up a real tempest. And in 1953, another bestseller, Flying Saucers from Outer Space, books based on material from Air Force and Canadian official sources. Major Kehoe, what are the most recent developments in this field of unidentified flying objects?
There are three very important developments which have been kept from the public. In the first place, there is at least one, and possibly two, artificial satellites circling the Earth at the present time. An intensive effort is being made by government scientists at White Sands, New Mexico, to locate and chart the courses of these satellites in an effort to determine what they are and where they came from. Secondly, within the last 2 weeks, Canadian government scientists have notified all official skywatches to be especially alert and to report immediately any unidentified aerial objects. The third development, which has been kept secret, is this. In the closing week of March, Air Force Secretary Talbot made two trips to Palm Springs, California in an Air Force plane. On one of those trips, shortly after the plane had passed Fresno, California, the crew of Secretary Talbot's plane discovered that it was being followed by a large, silvery, disc-shaped object, which was flying about 1,000 feet below the Secretary's plane and about 1,000 feet distant. The unidentified object was seen by Secretary Talbot, the crew of his plane, and Secretary Talbot's aide who accompanied him on the trip. After watching the disc for several minutes, Secretary Talbot ordered his plane to swing around and approach. The object immediately accelerated and disappeared at high speed. This was a daylight sighting of long duration by credible personnel and under very favorable conditions. In view of the tremendous amount of evidence that is being concealed by Air Force secrecy, it is high time the American people demanded to know the facts.
Thank you very much, Major Donald E. Kehoe, U.S. Marine Corps, retired.
And I mean, Kehoe, he was a key figure in the 50s and I think probably the early 60s. I think he died in the 1970s sometime, I think. But there's various YouTube interviews you can watch with Kehoe, you know, and he's quite an interesting guy to listen to. So, you know, he's well embedded into the UFO history. I mean, what happened with Smith is he was what it seemed, the way it seemed to work is he was being given information by Affet and Tyler through initially through Francis Swan, but I think then somehow Smith was getting the information directly. Somehow, I'm not sure how, but Grant told me, Grant Cameron, he said in one of his talks that it was really weird because he got to know Smith's wife, Grant Cameron did. I don't know if she's still alive. I think she's probably dead now. I know his son's still alive. Well, his son was still alive a few years ago. I think Wilbert Smith's son's in his 60s now. And Grant said when he was spending time with Smith's wife, you know, they were driving along in the car with him and, you know, other people, and it was like Affa was a member of the family. You know, Affa says this, Affa says that, you know. So it was really weird. He said that was really strange how they were talking about Affa as if he was a member of the family. But apparently Affa was also in contact with a blind telex operator in Ottawa. And in 1959, during one of Smith's gravity control experiments in his lab, where they were rotating a copper plate at 15,000 to 18,000 revolutions per minute, which Smith has written about elsewhere in some of the material Grant's got, the phone rang in Smith's lab, and the telex operator reported that he'd had a message from Affa saying that the experiment needed shielding, as in this rotating disc that was going around, so they didn't have it shielded. So they built a brick wall around the experiment, and then when they spun it up again for the next run, the thing blew up. So it's like Affa knew that what was going to happen. And again, that's, you know, one of these stories, but this is in the Smith archives. Smith also stated that he had a contact through an anonymous intermediary with another man from outside called Tyler, who described himself as a garbage collector. And he described one of the contacts from Tyler.
But he has had contact with one of these people from outside now for a period of 4 years that I know of, and I believe that this contact has preceded that by several years. This contact name, the man here on Earth, I cannot quote, but the man from outside, his name is Tyler, and he calls it the mess. By misbehaving, I mean cutting off nuclear explosions. Now, he gathers up this material, does something to it on board the craft, what we don't know, but it renders it reasonably inert. And then once a year, or thereabouts, it takes about a year to process this material, he dumps it in some rather secluded spot. I think it was 1947, November issue or December issue of Time magazine had a picture of Tyler's craft dumping this material out over the American desert. A year later, Tyler sent a message through my friend that he was going to dump some again, that he would this time pick an opportune time when many people could see me to witness the process, and that he would dump it somewhere near Ottawa. So shortly after the armistice celebrations down at Confusion Square in Ottawa, everyone was buzzing around town. It was a very pleasant day. We looked up to the northwest of Ottawa, and there was Tyler's little craft, the lake-shaped affair, up in the sky, and coming out of the tail end of this was what looked like an almost dissipated portion of a jet trail, and this was dropping down. It was a white, smoky-looking affair that was dropping down from the rear of this little craft, which was set at about an angle of 30, 45 degrees. Well, we watched this through binoculars. In fact, having been warned, we had these things handy. We stood out in the yard, and I think about half of Ottawa was out watching it, too. And the dump took about 20 minutes. We stood there and watched it, and this hail of dust getting lower and lower, and finally when we looked up again, Tyler's craft was gone. We didn't see him go. Maybe he just took off in a hurry when he figured the job was done. Anyway, we watched this dust until it had dissipated almost to the point where we couldn't really see it anymore, but by that time it was down pretty close to the horizon. Now, knowing the size of
So there you go. He said they saw Tyler's craft doing this end of the cleanup operation. So, you know, and this is Wilbert Smith. So, you know, make of it what you will, so to speak. But I take him very seriously because of his credentials and his background. But the really, again, one of the really interesting things about this case, and I think unique, actually, or yeah, I'd say probably unique, certainly with the people involved, he was actually giving, given information, that's all right, you can come in. He was given information, and he conducted some experiments which he showed it was possible to extract energy from the Earth's magnetic field. He thought this is what saucers use for both propulsion and as an energy source. So he felt that they were somehow extracting energy from the Earth's magnetic field. So he described this device as a magnetic sink, which energy would flow into. So it's where you capture magnetic energy. Now, I showed this circuit somewhere at a talk. This was a good few years ago. And a chap in the audience says, "Oh, yeah, I can't understand that circuit. Maybe one or two of the symbols, I know what they are." But he said, "Yeah, I can understand that circuit. I know what it's for." So, you know, it is a valid circuit, as far as I've been told. So he was using that to collect energy from the Earth's magnetic field. Not a lot, probably only, you know, a few milliwatts, probably of that. But that apparently is what it did. But yeah, let's hear another clip of Smith talking about what he called the boys' top side. In other words, Affer and Tyler and people like him. So they built two items of hardware, and there was this one, which is the binding meter, which he built.
They gave us the design of the instrument, which was fundamentally this. They said to select two materials, one stronger than the other. And they said to arrange so that these two materials pulled against each other in such a manner that the weaker material was very near its breaking point, and the strong material was a long way from its breaking point. On that basis, we devised instruments, and we built quite a number of them in the shop, sent them around to various people that we knew did quite a bit of traveling. And we asked them if they would investigate the regions through which aircraft must have passed just prior to breaking up in midair. And we have, unfortunately, a large record of our airplane having done just this. One of these unexplained crashes occurred at a place called Etudes, which is about 20 miles south and west of Quebec City. And we investigated the region through which the BOAC aircraft must have passed just prior to the crash. And sure enough, big as life and twice as natural, we found a very large and very strong vortex. Our instruments showed it beyond a doubt. It was about 1,000 feet in diameter and roughly circular, with a rather sharp line of demarcation at the edge of it.
So he built this binding meter, which was measuring this force, which is not acknowledged by physics, which helps to stuff to actually stick together, to stay, you know, in coherency or whatever, just to stay. And he was arguing that some of these plane crashes, and there were a few, were caused by the plane sort of falling apart, or, you know, the structure somehow becoming compromised because it was travelling through these regions of low binding, and that's what this binding meter was meant to measure. And he said he gave these to people, and they were able to measure this going up and down. And it wasn't to do with temperature or pressure. It was something else. That's what he said. And then the other one was that he made was this coil. So I'll just play this clip of him talking about the coil.
One of those pieces of hardware is a coil. It has a ferrite core and a trip winding on it. To look at it, it looks like a rather oddly wound inductor. When measured on a radio frequency bridge, however, it shows some very peculiar properties. There are certain frequencies at which it is impossible to balance the RF bridge, and that is a direct contradiction to what any electrical engineer will tell you should happen with a coil wire wound on a ferrite core. Now, if we take this coil and we excite it with radio frequency energy at or near these critical frequencies, we find that energy goes into the coil and nothing comes out. It just disappears. As a matter of fact, we had one coil about an inch in diameter and 8 inches long, and we poured a kilowatt into that coil for 2 hours from a kilowatt communications type transmitter. The coil was in a 2-inch brass tube with a plate welded on one end and a transmission line sitting on the other. We could find no radiation around the outside of that tube at all. In other words, the energy went in, none came out. The information which we got from the voice outside was that we were actually making tensor energy, which is a six-dimensional radio wave. And it is the type of energy that they use extensively for radio communication, transmission of power, and for pushing and pulling. Fact is, they use it for just about everything that we could think of.
So he was saying he was given these instructions to make this coil. Then he did measurements on the coil using the standard procedures that he would use for other types of equipment which he was working on. And this produced completely different sets of readings, which he couldn't explain. And he said that the contacts that he was in touch with, the boys topside, said that he was creating this type of energy. He called it tensor energy. I mean, it's not an expression I'm familiar with, but that's what he said. And then he was told about gravity control as well. And this is what he said. So, he was given information, he built stuff, it worked. You know, maybe not spectacularly in terms of, he didn't build his own flying saucer or anything like that. I don't think that was his intention. But he could see that the effects that they told him would be there were real. And going back to the binding forces thing, the binding meter, I was doing a radio show a while ago, and somebody phoned in and said, well, do you think these binding forces that he was talking about, is that what they were modifying in the destruction of the World Trade Center? Molecular dissociation, how about changing the binding forces within the molecules and the atoms within? So I think it could well be the same thing that Smith was investigating in the 50s with this binding meter. It's related to... No, not that I'm not. People aren't using them. I think the binding meter is fairly easy to build. If you've got a machine shop, you could try it. It's not something I can build myself easily. But maybe actually it's something I could get a friend of Richard's to try and do. I think other people have tried to build them, but I don't think they've published any results to my knowledge. I haven't looked, and there may be some web pages about it now because I came across this for the first time over 10 years ago. Yeah. So it's quite possible that. Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah, it's not that difficult. I mean, yeah. So maybe somebody has reproduced it. I should look really and see if I can update this in any way. But the other really interesting thing, of course, is the source of hardware, because of what Smith was doing and his expertise and his skills, which you've heard a little bit about. He became a contact for the U.S. government, and he was sent stuff. Smith corresponded with several people stating that he had handled a number of pieces of source of hardware from crashes or military encounters, and he'd been involved in their analysis. Art Bridge, who Grant Cameron interviewed, I've gotten that interview on a disc somewhere. The audio quality is not very good, but you can understand what he's saying. One of Smith's associates stated that they were involved in an analysis of a lot of hardware. They were sent a lot of stuff, a lot of pieces over, you know, 5-10 years, whatever. And also, Jim Smith, which was Walt Smith's son, he handled one or more of these pieces, as he describes in this clip.
So he came from the States. Yeah, that's what I was looking for. On more than one occasion, there were these pieces that were sent to him?
On several occasions, and they'd be of different sizes, and there was no regularity to it at all. He'd send them away for analysis, and try to cut pieces off them, and
so they didn't know where the analyses went. Another piece that they spent a lot of time investigating was this Ottawa piece. It suddenly appeared on the shore of St. Lawrence River in 1960, 3 tons approximately, composed of high-strength manganese steel fabricated in layers of 0.01 to 0.8 inches thick, according to Smith. It looked like the thing had been subject to impact as it fell on a hard surface with very high velocity. The flat, presumably the top of the surface, was embedded with myriads of particles tentatively identified as micrometeorites. Analysis showed that it contained known elements, but such as we do not normally use in steels, and it was held by the Ottawa Flying Saucer Club for a number of years, so I think there was a big, long discussion of that, but I don't think at the end of it it turned up anything particularly interesting. But that, you know, again, they were alleging that might possibly be a piece of a craft which had fallen to the earth somehow, but that was never proved. But also Jim Smith talked about the viewing of alien bodies, or his father doing that. Jim Smith didn't see them.
Yes, he saw that.
on the wall at those social gatherings, isn't it?
Unbelievable. Did he describe them at all? Did you recall anything?
Not that I can recall, except that the descriptions that had sort of been out and about were fairly accurate. The descriptions that were out and about were fairly accurate. Did we have descriptions of greys at that time?
I think there were descriptions of smallish types. I don't know about necessarily the coloring.
I don't remember a lot of those details. Mm-hmm. I just read them. It satisfied my curiosity that he had seen them and that they were real.
So Wilbur Smith said to his son that he saw the alien bodies wherever. I don't know if Jim Smith knows where Wilbur Smith saw them, but he did see them, and he said that when he was dying. So again, is he going to make that up? I don't know if Area 51 even existed in the 50s. I think a lot of the stuff went on at Wright-Patterson. That's allegedly where the Roswell bodies were taken, to Wright-Patterson, or Wright Field, I think, as it was called then. And there's several witnesses that have identified that as being the place. So it may have been that Smith went to Wright Field and did some work there, you know. And he was using some of his radio work as a cover for that. But, you know, Smith, I mean, he essentially got to the point that some of us, including me, have probably got to. Smith felt that there was little point in trying to establish the reality of UFOs. Do they exist? And this debate still goes on today, you know. Do UFOs exist is the question that you see in the, you know. Of course they exist. You know, it's a question of what are they? That's the thing. So the question they pose is wrong anyway. But Smith felt there was little point in trying to establish the reality of the phenomenon. And he said that replowing and plowing and replowing the same field, he got bored of doing the investigations. He knew that they were real. He wanted to find out what it all was meant, you know. He wasn't really interested. I mean, the group that I go to, they just talk about sightings and stuff like that, you know. They don't really go much beyond that. He wanted, but Smith did want to go beyond that. He wanted to find out more about what was actually going on, what it meant. And in the last few years of his life, Smith turned his attention to the task of trying to rewrite the whole idea of scientific thinking from the ground up, based on what he had learned from his experience and his experiments, and from the boy's topside. And if you read his book, The New Science, which is incomplete, but you can get a copy of it on the web, I've read it, he states at the beginning of this work, assembled by W.B. Smith from data obtained from beings more advanced than we are. He actually says that in the beginning. The work is available on the internet and deals with more in metaphysics initially rather than science, describing concepts of nothingness, awareness, reality, space. He looks at those concepts and breaks it down in those terms. And he talks about fields a lot. And Smith was unable to finish the book. He died before he properly finished it. But what's there is quite interesting if you read it. It's very interesting. So, again, I've just given you a thumbnail sketch of the story of Smith. Grant Cameron's got a load more information. Grant, I've got a two-hour talk by Grant, which covers a bit more than this, than I've covered. But he was looking at sightings, he investigated sightings, he talked about alien contact, he talked about viewing alien bodies, he talked about energy technology, he talked about anti-gravity technology, and he handled pieces of sources and did some analysis. And he also talked about official reticence. That was his name for cover-up. He called it official reticence. That was his name for it. He also had a realisation that metaphysics is important in understanding the phenomena, which few people today speak of. They don't really talk about that. It's a bit more now, perhaps, but not in the way that Smith did. He did it in a different, slightly different way. But that he did all of that between late 1940. He did that in 12 years. And he was saying all this stuff. I mean, he died in 62, for heaven's sake. So this is 53 years since he died. So he was way ahead. He was way out there, way out in front, you know. And he's even ahead of where some people are now, you know, and what they talk about. So what I went on to next was just further disclosures and stuff related to the sorts of things that Smith said, and then I finished off with the Smith. Right at the end, I'll go back to Smith. Let's see, because it's 4:45 now, isn't it? So, I don't know whether you want me to go straight through or have a break, or what do you think? I can go through this bit, maybe have a break after this, but we'll see. But we can just want a break. Douglas Aircraft. Now this, I don't know if you, I probably haven't spoken about this before. To you, but although it's not a secret. But this was also known as BIT BR, which is an abbreviation for Boys in the Back Room. Boys in the Back Room. That was what they called it. McDonnell Douglas and UFOs. McDonnell Douglas is an aircraft company, originally called Douglas Aircraft. Then it merged with McDonnell to become McDonnell Douglas, which then was taken over eventually by Boeing. So it's what is now Boeing. These documents pertain to the research of a small team of people in McDonnell Douglas Aircraft Corporation in 1967 to 1969. They show, you know, this is just to show some people that they, you know, there was official interest in corporations in the UFO phenomenon. They did a serious investigation, and these documents prove it. They show that some people there took the UFO phenomenon seriously, and they regarded them as real physical objects worth studying in detail, with a view to developing a new method of propulsion based on a new theory of physics. So that was their motivation. They were in it for selfish reasons. They weren't in it for, oh, what does it all mean? They wanted to get technology out of it that they could use in their business. That's what McDonnell Douglas were interested in. But they kept it sort of secret. They kept it confidential. In total, there are about 200 pages of documents. I think about 225 pages I've got. But some of those are just cover sheets. And I've got a few of these here. The documents are left in a barn, which may have belonged to a Douglas employee who died or moved. We don't know. But the new owner of the place found the files, and then he sold them on eBay for $31. And in March 2005, someone made contact with Grant Cameron, and he made contact with me, and we uploaded the documents to my website because I had enough web space to host these 200 pages. And they, you know, took a few megabytes at the time. So they were uploaded to my PC via FTP by a guy called Louis. I forget his second name, but his first name was Louis. And gathering information from contactees is described in these documents. And that was a second main avenue of deriving useful data on the UFO propulsion. And the documents were written between March 1967 and December 1969. And they were written by J.M. Brown, Bob Wood. Anyone heard of Bob Wood? I'll mention him again in a minute. W.P. Wilson and D.B. Harmon. Now, if you go onto YouTube, you can find presentations by J.M. Brown. I found one or two by him, because he came up with a whole theory of physics called the kinetic particle theory, which he developed in some of these documents. Now, Bob Wood, I found out later after we published these documents that he wasn't totally happy about us publishing them, because he'd worked on them and it was kind of secret. But it was in the 60s, but he wasn't especially happy. I didn't know that before I published them, but I thought, hey. But interestingly, his son, Ryan Wood, has just sent me his book. For some reason, Ryan Wood wrote to me a couple of weeks ago and said, can I send you my book, Magic Eyes Only, about the majestic documents and stuff and flying saucer crashes. And he said, oh, Andrew, can I send you my book? And I says, yeah, of course you can. So he sent me, and I got it yesterday, I think. Was it yesterday or the day before? No, a couple of days ago, about Wednesday, I think I got it. I haven't read it yet. But Edgar Fouché said that he met Ryan Wood at conference, and Ryan Wood had no interest in talking to Edgar Fouché for some reason. So I don't know why. Maybe they didn't hit it off. But their rationale for the use of contactee data is best derived from the so-called Advanced Vehicle Concepts research presentation, which was like sort of like a PowerPoint presentation. If you look at it, I've got this whole document. It's about 50 pages long, but it's just like slides. You know, it's done like over. It's done with an overhead projector, I would think. Philosophy that they had was hear everything and use some of it to our advantage, which goes back to the commercial advantage. Contactee data could be useful experiencing high accelerations without forces, visual internal appearance of vehicles. That's the information they were looking at. What things were inside, what people reported as seeing. I sent electronic copies of these documents to Nick Cook, a defence journalist at James Defence Weekly, who I've talked about before. And they were featured in UFOs, The Secret Evidence, a documentary which was broadcast on Channel 4 on 13th of October 2005. They actually showed a clip of about five minutes on these documents which I sent him. So there you go. Oh, some of these pictures have somehow disappeared. They're not vital. Why is that? Just have a look. Oh, come on, man.
That's weird.
I don't know why it's done that. No, they've just disappeared, look. Is that because I had it linked in? Let's just see if... That might be just to do with how it's linked in. So I'll have a little break, because I've got another copy on my stick, which I'll see if that actually shows them. That's why the Betty and Barney Hill have been abducted, I think, from it. So that, let me just put this in here. My USB stick. This is the thing I get out and I say to people, what I've got on here will blow your mind. I don't actually, but I could. It may even be true. So let me just go on to that.
Doctor one in your pocket as well.
The doctor one?
Yeah.
Which?
Sonic screwdriver.
Oh, no, I haven't got a sonic screwdriver. Haven't got a sonic screwdriver.
Why not?
No, I don't know. It's just something I haven't, you know. Let's just see if this works. I'll go on to, where are you? Let's see if this one works any better. Give it a minute to load. Alright, so let's go down a bit, see if those pictures are in it. Oh yeah, so it looks like the Betty and Barney Hill ones were there, weren't they?
Yeah, Betty and Barney Hill were back, weren't they?
They've landed again. So in case you didn't see those... I think you probably know what George Adamski looks like. There's Betty and Barney Hill. So there's them. So if I now go to the other one I was on... That's weird, that, though. I don't know why it's messed that up. Because it's just copied from my other computer. Oh, so there, we're just about there. There we go. So these are just a couple of pages from... Because there's like hundreds of pages. A lot of it's pretty dry, you know.
Is this on your website?
Yeah.
I have to
check that out. Yeah. You can download the whole lot. Yeah. You know, they're just sort of research material.
You could do that.
But, you could if you wanted. But they described here like having an electron source and a sorter... And then a strong magnet, and they're doing stuff like that with electrons and electron guns and that sort of thing. And another experiment, I think. Another describes the experiment to measure the effect of a magnetic field on a beam of light. So they wanted to see if they could deflect a beam of light using a strong magnetic field, but I don't think they got anything out of that. But these were the sorts of things they were looking at and seeing if they could get any information out of. That was one of their goals. And then there was even some satirical cartoons, and this is very unclear because it's like a photocopy of a photocopy or whatever, and it's also probably done from an overhead acetate. And if you see that there, it says United States Air Force UFO Information Center on the door of the office, and the guys in the office are all tied to the chairs, and there's an alien answering the phone. And it says, the alien's saying, I assure you, madam, if any such creatures as you describe really existed, we would be the first to know about it. So that was actually in that presentation. And J.M. Brown, he tried to develop this, I mentioned this a few minutes ago, a new theory to explain the behaviour of particles and the way in which the propulsion systems of UFOs may operate. And he called it the kinetic particle theory. And it was based around the idea of what he called a bruttino, which was, he said, was this fundamental particle which was involved in all these forces. And this is actually quite similar to... Because if you've ever heard of Dr. Paul LaViolette, he's done stuff on UFOs and he talks about this galactic superwave. He's come up with something called subquantum kinetics. He's written about subquantum kinetics, and he's written a sort of paper on that, which sounded quite similar to this kinetic particle theory, but they've worked totally independently. So, But I get sent these sorts of things every so often. People sending me stuff about their... In fact, I've just got one from this Portuguese chap about the theory of gravity, the electric universe and the theory of gravity. He's just sent me that yesterday, the final version of it, apparently. But what was interesting is that McDonnell Douglas, they even considered paying a contactee, whose name was Barbara J. Hickox, and they interviewed her and they said, we discussed the possibility of employing Mrs. Hickox as a consultant. We told her that if she accepted employment as a consultant, the company would expect to own any ideas divulged by her. So again, you're all back to this commercial aspect of it. She would in return receive the agreed upon hourly compensation. We agreed to proceed with the background information gathering to prepare a recommendation to our management that she be employed as a consultant at a rate of slightly over $3 an hour. If our checks on her resulted in our recommendation to management, and if the management concurred, then a few exploratory hours of her time would be utilised. Further time might then be warranted to go into various areas in great depth, primarily in her description of the vehicle and its propulsion system. So they wanted to employ people, wanted to employ contactees in the 1960s. So there you go. Okay. Well, some of this is probably a little bit out of date now, actually. But there are some interesting statements from astronauts about disclosure. So maybe... is it? Do you want to do more tea? Have a break, and then we'll do the astronauts. Yes.
Go make us tea, children.
I'm going to have a break to cough a bit.
I'm going to have a break. Are you tired? I'm going to go to the toilet in a minute.
Really?
I need to go to the toilet.
You have to go upstairs then.
Why?
Because Mum said.
I was going to ask something. A few slides back, maybe think of something.
If I go back, just and see what alien. Yes. Do you think? I'll give it a go in a minute. Hang on, I'm going to go to the loo first, though.
Yeah, I'll let you do that. Cause
oh, thank you. They're so kind for letting me go to the loo. How did you... did I say that?
No, no.
Did I say I'm desperate to go to the toilet? So, no point... no, I don't know. Maybe which one was it? New Science? Smith and Alien Bodies? Jim Smith, his son... Nick Cook and the documents.
Oh, documents.
Oh, in fact, is that? Have I got a clip of that? Maybe I have. Let's have a look. Ooh.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. I'll just go to the loo on that, please.
Clipping's good.
I've forgotten I got that clip.
But what really fascinates me as a question is that you are as likely to.
So it's a good job you made me go back.
Plus, all their free tickets, taking money away from everyone, energy and stuff. They're never going to say anything. They're never going to reveal what they're developing at this point. They basically said, right, these people aren't worth knowing. We're going to, like old Dolan says, it is a breakaway civilization. They're not going to start going, oh, shall we tell them now? They're making everyone dumb. They're dumbing everyone down so much that people won't even think about what's going on in space now. And they can say any old crap about NASA and think that they're so advanced.
I'm looking.
This came out of his beard.
Oh,
like a bird's nest.
And he's not Mr. Twit, is he?
There, it's stuck. And then it's disappeared.
Magic.
Gosh.
And then it's back.
So how do you do your thing again so I can see how you do your hands? I bet I can't do it. I might have to sit on the floor or something.
I'll put
it back then. He might need it for later.
Embedded
treasure.
So can you go over there?
I have a good idea.
So it's can you?
I've never done yoga in the middle of my talk, so I'm not sure. Right, so I've got to go. No. How do I do it? I've got to go under my. Oh gosh, no, I can't do that. I've got my wallet in my pocket as well. Oh. There's no way. There's no way, Sadie. I'm going to have to lie right back, aren't I?
Like that?
Yeah. Can you do it, Sans? Sans, can you...
I'll probably split my jeans.
Can you have some space?
How do you do it?
Go out. I need some space.
No, I can't do it. I can't do it.
Go on, Cyrus is going to have a go.
I'm going to have to do more yoga, I think. I have to practice.
You should do Tibetan rites.
Yes.
So for the first one you do...
No, that's not it.
Is. You do each one 21 times.
21.
The first one you do. First one you do is this.
Okay.
So like that.
Yep.
You look to the right.
Yes.
You do that. You just look at your right hand the whole time.
Right.
And then you don't get giddy. And then when you stop, you just do that. Keep your eyes closed. And
yes.
Stop spinning really quickly.
Okay.
Then the next one you do is... Next one you do, you go like that. You lie like that.
Yeah.
And then you go, your leg up like that.
Oh, okay.
Head up like that. You do that 21 times.
Oh, 21 times?
Yeah.
And you do that in the morning?
You can build it up, say, to 5 times.
5 times, right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Build it up. Once you're used to it, it's quite easy.
Yeah.
The next one is... Which one is this? Oh. You go like this.
Smile.
You do your hand like that. And then you go back.
Yeah.
You go down.
Right, yeah.
Round.
Yeah.
You do that 21 times. So next one is an L shape. Sit you like this. Auntie Helen taught me all this. Then you just go up like that.
That's not an L shape.
21 times.
That is like that's an L shape. That, no, that's an L shape, but not when you move up.
No, when
not.
You do that.
Owl.
You feel that no, here that and bad. That. How really good arm strength in that one. The next one is the down dog. So that's the fourth one. What?
I need that. He's taking it away from my toes.
And the next one is, I'll have to adjust myself for this. Down dog, up dog. So you go.
Get away from me.
So you go like this. Down dog. Up dog.
Oh gosh.
Down dog.
And 21 times.
Up dog.
Up dog. But you don't put your body down here. You hover.
So you have to hold it.
Like that. And it's really good for your lower back, and it's really good for the back of your neck.
That's my
favourite one because it feels so good when you do it. At first, when you do it, it's like, ooh, but once you start getting used to it, it feels really good. But I've added a few other ones in, like in between the floor ones, I do, I just do that.
The neck rolls.
Yeah, and then neck. I do complete neck rolls like that.
Yeah, my mummy used to do that. My mummy used to do the neck rolls.
Yeah, and then you go back.
Yeah. That's one I do know.
Very good. And what else? I must improve my bust.
I've heard of that one before as well. I don't do that myself, though.
All few other little bits that I've added in. It takes about 10 to 15 minutes.
Daddy, you want to get
and
it?
I do it basically, I get up in the morning and I start. Before I go in the shower. But only on weekdays, weekends, I sort of have more relaxed time. So weekdays, every weekday morning, I'll do that. Get up, shower. And then get on, so, you know, before school, basically. And then if you get it done that way in the morning, it really wakes you up, gets your body stretched, and feels really good. Doing it about 3 years now.
That's good thing to do, you know.
So just, it's such a good thing to bring into your life. You don't want to...
I don't like this idea of going out and running. And
it's very bad for your ankles, it's very bad for your knee joints as well. Auntie Helen always says, see, Uncle Omar's obsessed with running. That's what he does, really. He won't do Tibetan rides, but you need to stay flexible. It's the most important thing is to be flexible.
Yeah.
A lot of people just do running. Like Ed, he can run 12 miles, but he can't bend his shoelaces very well. So he goes up like that, you know? So he needs to do sort of bending like that. And but he used to do it when he used to do his professional boxing. He used to do loads of it. But he stopped, didn't he? And he just became... policeman, and then he was just doing his running and stuff after he retired and whatnot.
Right.
And he's super stiff now, but really healthy in other ways. Oh, I'd love you to meet Ed. You probably will meet him at some point. For a minute, when that doorbell went earlier,
don't remember him.
I thought it might have been Ed. Kids, do not start being naughty. Come, cuddle mama.
Oh. He bumped his head.
Come on, should we
kiss? They tend to get a bit hyper at this sort of time, don't they?
Should we make some tea and have some nice drink? Would you like some sparkly water, Simon?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want chocolate.
You've got too much chocolate,
mate. Now, I bet you got that lamp because it's got a shade like a flying saucer on my right.
Of course. I know, it's wonderful, isn't it?
Oh, did that get left up there? Right, that's fair enough. I don't mind, but... Yeah. I'm glad you picked that up because I might have left it.
Yeah, try and get it.
That's right, the box is out in the
hallway. You won't be going because I'm trapping you in a room.
So you threatened.
I'm going to rope Mr. Campbell because he's the brute strength behind this endeavour.
Well, I shall call upon the powers of the magical skull to defend me and protect me.
So who's going around doing talks about that now?
Who is?
Yeah.
I think the short answer is nobody.
Terrible. You're going to have to do some, Andrew.
Well, that's a short answer. The slightly longer answer is Matthew Brownstein, did I tell you about him?
Possibly.
Well, I'll tell you about him.
Go and take it away, please.
What happened with, which I was sort of slightly curious about, was Laurie told me just not long before he died, because I saw him in September, which was about 2 months before he died. Probably 3 months. And he told me that what happened was he'd met this guy called Matthew Brownstein. He was a hypnotherapist. Maybe not a hypnotherapist. But I know he did life coaching. And he'd made quite a lot of money out of it. And he had a big office in an office block in Tampa, you know, good view out over Tampa, and I think he was a dollar millionaire at least. I think he was fairly, you know, reasonably well off. And Lloyd had been to see him because Lloyd wanted to see if he could change his, you know, outlook in a way that would help him to raise funds for research into the skull. So somebody had suggested that he go and see this Matthew Brownstein, you know, like quit smoking, but accept how you attract, you know, good things into your life, these life coaches that claim to be able to do that. You know, I was a bit sceptical, as probably you are too, but, you know, but I think some of it, you know, does have some value for certain people at certain times in their life, perhaps. I think that sort of thing can be quite valuable.
It's quite an American thing as well.
Yeah, I think there's less people do it over here. But anyway, so he went to see the guy, and then he told him about the skull, and this Matthew Brownstein guy, oh, that's very interesting, I'd like to find out more about that. And what happened was over a period of, I think, a year or something, he said, I'd like to get involved with this and help fund it, you know. And Lloyd said, oh, okay, you know, that'd be great, you know, if you've got a bit of money. But then, and then Lloyd told me they'd formed this business deal between Lloyd, Matthew Brownstein, and... Ray and Melanie Young.
Yeah, that's
the owners.
The owners. Yeah.
And Amy Vickers, who's Lloyd's ex-wife. She was involved quite a lot with setting up the website and keeping the thing going. Amy did a lot of work on that. And so I thought, oh, business, what's this business deal then? You know, I wasn't really quite sure what this was. So I said, so whose idea was this then, Lloyd? And he said, oh, it was Matthew Brownstein's. Oh, okay. So it was like he was, why do you need a business deal kind of thing? You know, well, I suppose what they were aiming to do was raise funds to make a documentary about the DNA testing and all of that. Mm-hmm. And they reckoned it was going to need about $2 million. $250,000 for the testing, or something, $500,000, I can't remember. And then they needed the rest of the money to make a documentary about it. So that was what the proposal was, and Matthew Brownstein, you know, encouraged them to do this business deal, which apparently they all signed. All of them signed this business deal. And, of course, by about a year later, Lloyd was dead.
Yeah.
But the slightly peculiar thing was, is one time, you know, I logged onto the Star Child Project website, and it was gone, you know, it was just dead. It was like error 404 or whatever, so I... And then I waited a couple of days, 3 or 4 days, and I logged on again, and it was still like that. I contacted Amy, you know, you know who she is. And she said, I don't know what's wrong with it. I don't know what's wrong with the website. And the tech guy that I'm speaking to, he doesn't answer my emails and stuff, you know, or something. So I said, well, look, you know, if you send me the passwords, and she'd given me the passwords previously, I'll have a look at it for you. So she sent me the passwords, and I sort of looked into it. I managed to fix it. It only took me about half an hour to fix it. I managed to work out what was wrong with it, and I fixed it, and I got it going again. It was something to do with the database, because a lot of websites now have databases built into them, which you don't really see, you know, but they're there in the background. And one of the database tables had got messed up, so I followed the error and, you know, and worked it out from that, and then just... ran a thing to fix the database, and then I didn't even know if it would work. You know, it was just read the web page and did the thing, and then it worked. So, but you know, the thing was, I was glad to help and everything, you know, because it was Star Child. But why am I doing that? You know, I don't pay any money into it. Why haven't they got somebody to do that? Why didn't Matthew Brownstein get it? Why wasn't he on it?
Yeah.
You know, getting somebody to sort it out. You know, I mean, Amy's not techie trained, she's tried to build the website, but then Lloyd told me, for example, that Amy wanted a new laptop or a new computer to help do the website because she didn't have one, and that she thought was part of, you know, fair enough, she's like an employee of the Star Child project, and this guy's a flipping millionaire, surely he can fork out for a flipping laptop, you know, 400 quid, 300 quid or something, can't he? I mean, surely.
Yeah, tools yeah. Of the trade.
Yeah, exactly. You know, even if she's not getting a salary or anything like that, you'd expect at least to get a flipping laptop for her. But apparently he was curmudgeonly about that, according to what Lloyd told me. You know, so...
So why would he enter into strange business thing?
Because he thought it was going to be a way of getting money into the... You know, if somebody else was offering to do the fundraising, you know, great stuff, which is why they did the crowdfunding, because I think that was Matthew Brownstein's idea. That's why they did the crowdfunding. But they didn't, you know, I think they only got about a third of what they put on the target. I think they were aiming to get $50,000 and they only got about $15,000 or something, you know, from that campaign. I'm pretty sure they didn't get their target.
It's, you know, it's so, they don't put this on anywhere, do they? That's
not really.
It's hard to... It's like Dr. Wood stuff.
It's very similar.
It's so hard to get the information out. But I think when there is this real information, it's suppressed.
But I think, like you say, you know, I think so. You know, why don't people mention it in their talks? You know, I don't think I've seen anybody... I think I maybe see one or two talks, perhaps, I'm hard pushed to think of even which ones they would be that have mentioned this. Yeah, you need at least expend. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you need at least bet. You know, you've got a PowerPoint slide. Oh yeah, well, I'm not going to talk about this in detail, but go and look at Star Child, and you'll find really interesting stuff about that. Bum, you know. Stanton Freeman doesn't talk about it. You know.
Yeah. Did he even look at the skull when we were that thing?
Gary did. I mean, he knew about it, but I don't think. I think he probably knew enough about it, but. You know.
Gary's kind of. His talk was a bit simplistic in some areas, wasn't it?
Really bit.
Bringing out that. So just that he was missing the point and a lot of.
I thought he was
a
little bit.
I can't remember what we were whispering specifically about. He said something just like. It's more complex than what he's stating to everyone in that room.
I think so.
Yeah.
Do you want to make some tea? Because I'm going on again, aren't I?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's make tea.
I put the kettle on.
You did?
I did that. Can I help you, Andrew? I sort of left side of his bed because I hadn't done it.
I'll come and help you. You're doing all the tea otherwise. You've been doing all the tea all weekend. Just move the bag so that they don't trip over it. Oh, is that? Oh, that's just out the bottom. It's just a felt pen. I thought somebody's. It looks like an iPhone, doesn't it? It's about the same size, but it's just my little camera bag pad. Can't remember. Oh, where did I put my camera? Oh, it's over there. That's all right. That's one I brought through, but I don't think, was that mine? I don't think that was mine. Mine was one of the other ones. I think it was, I think that was, it's either that one or the other one. I think that
one
was mine.
This one's mine.
Right.
Ask Mr. Campbell if you want coffee, Andrew.
Did you want coffee?
Yeah.
I'll ask him. Do you want tea or coffee, Matt?
No, thank you.
Nothing?
No.
Okay.
I tried to defend myself, but I had to restrict it.
So Mr. C doesn't want anything at the moment. He says he's fine. Oh, hello. Mushka?
Mushka. Prim!
I might remember her name one day.
She's known as Prim as well.
And so you have that arrangement of boxes because she likes that, is that right?
Yeah, she likes a little bit over it as well.
Give a nice bit of shelter.
I put it over the other day and she really took to it.
So you've left it, that's
she
good.
She miffed if you take the top off.
Oh. Hello, puss, it's alright. You don't know me very well, do you? So you're a little bit suspicious.
That's what she's like with me. She's like that with everybody. She's aloof.
Aloof? Well, cats can be very aloof, can't they?
She's like Candace Hillegoss and Carnival of Souls. All aloof and beautiful and otherworldly. don't you just love the Mr. Linden in Carnival of Souls? He's slimy and like.
I'd have to watch it again because
and
he's I, you know.
Going, he realises she doesn't like being alone and he's like, you don't want to be alone again, do you? And like, always like, oh, it's just so funny. He's such a great character. I just love that film so much.
I know.
There's the boys.
Oh, it's, look, the and eyes have come in.
Look.
He's seen me, look. Look.
With pretty eyes. I love cat's eyes. They're so beautiful, aren't they?
Yeah. Hello, puss. Are you coming in? I think this is Willoughby then, yeah? Because he's been a bit shy of me. I think he's seen me.
Sometimes they get a bit lazy and they see you in here and they're like, well, let me in then. Hello, baby. Yeah, that's Willoughby.
Yeah.
He lost a bit of fur in the back of his, these parts of his legs. When we went to the vets the day I fainted, we said, oh, what's wrong with his legs? And he's been over licking himself.
All right.
I think because of all the dust from doing all the plastering and
taking
that wall, I think it's made him groom too much. He's got an habit of grooming, he's over-grooming that part because that's the easiest part to reach when he's lying down. I think that's what it is. So hopefully, because the house was in mayhem for a couple of months.
Yeah,
cats can go funny.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of upheaval.
Yeah. So we were having our bathroom done, you know, and Mitzi was not pleased about other people being in the house while that was going on.
Yeah. What's the bathroom going to look like? What colour is it and stuff?
I don't know actually.
Is
the guy sort of doing it, and you know, we're giving him some vague ideas, and we're just going to leave him to it.
Yeah.
You know, but it's just going to be nothing fancy. You know, it'll just be like a green colour or a bluish colour. You know, we're not going to have anything fancy. So.
Next thing
we'll
do is kitchen. Yeah. Utility. We need to make the porch bigger. We're going to build a porch out. Instead of having the front door where it is and then you come in and have it straight in front, but we're going to have it come up further so it goes up to that window for the studio. So it's going to give a lot more room there. And we can build a cupboard into it. And it'll be just better than you just walk in through the door and then the front door's there.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having to go that way and round and along, then the cupboard will fit all the coats and shoes and stuff. So it'd be much better.
Let me take one. Can I take mine?
Yeah, you take yours and I can take mine.
Righty, yeah, no, it'd be good.
Look, this is the stuff.
Yeah. Really, I did actually see some upstairs, and I realised that now. I used a little bit this morning. It's aniseed, isn't it?
Did you try some?
Yeah, I did, yeah, because it was on the winter.
It's really nice, isn't it?
Mm. That was good.
That's what Auntie Helen uses in Uncle Omar as well. And Susie.
Sure. Absolutely.
Wow, I'm so thirsty. Look, it's lovely outside.
I need it! Is it tonight? Oh, yeah. Except for garish clouds. In fact, we've still got the garish clouds in the same place, haven't we? More or less, just above the tree line.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks like a triangle, doesn't it? Can you see that one?
Oh, that. Wow.
I mean, it probably isn't. It's just because of the light, but it does look triangular, doesn't it?
Oh, I want to see TR3B. So when Ronnie said about that, did he just describe what it looked like?
Yeah, he was describing it.
Was it daytime or night?
I don't know. It was daylight. It was in daylight. He definitely said that, but I don't know where he was.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just one of those synchronicity things, because he just started describing it, and it was just the exact description of that diagram that's in that Ed Fouché gave me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, was it like, and that's when I got my laptop, I whipped it out and said, I whipped it out, matron, and said, did it like this?
You'll see.
Did it look like this?
You need to see Shooting Stars.
Oh, I messed up. Check that out.
So funny. That's hilarious. Well, how did you drink the babies quickly as well?
The children. Yes, do.
Thirsty.
So, yeah, so that was, and I said to him that was a synchronicity, and then he said, thanks for showing me that, you know. It's just a shame he was having to go, you know.
Could have
a bit longer. But c'est la vie, as they say.
Well, we're gonna get them again when Philip's better and, you know. Which one of them? Would you like to sparkle water as well? Would you want some?
No, just the tea's fine for me, thanks. Yeah, thank you.
Well, I'm really thirsty. Kids, calm down! I've got this lemon finish. Lemon's so nice and water.
Mmm. It's good for you as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Have you heard about doing frozen lemons?
No.
Where you put the cooked lemon in half, put it in the freezer, and then, you know, what you do is you get a lemon squeezer or something like that, and with a frozen lemon, you just, like, put that on the... what do you call it? The juicer thing.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then you put the granules onto your food, and you just have frozen lemon granules on your food. Yeah, yeah. Just Google it. Just put frozen lemons, and it's supposed to be very, very healthy, you know. And
Auntie Helen's cat Luda has been diagnosed with cancer.
Oh yeah, you said.
But she's been giving him the apricot kernels. Having the diarrhea.
Wow.
Every time I see him on Skype, he looks so perky and just like.
Oh, good. I didn't know it'd work with cats.
So, yeah, it's doing really, really well. Huge difference. Just in like a week.
Oh, really?
Just 1 week. That's huge difference. I mean, he was doing it. There was little dribbles of poo over his continent and very diarrhea-y. 1 week. Completely.
What?
Amazing. Luda, remember Luda was being ill all over the summer? When, even when Grandma was there and they had to clear up bits of Luda's poo all around the house. Now he's not doing it. It's all better. It's really good when we feel the slide was relieved. Okay. You know, if you just stop
that's a nasty cough.
Getting overexcited, it helps.
Sambucol is good for coughs and colds. Have you? Did we talk about that? Have you got Sambucol for the children?
That?
It's like just. It's based on elderberry.
And,
you could. We use that for round two.
Excuse me.
You can get it 3 for 2 from Boots. Sambucol.
It's like you're a teacher.
It's just for colds. It's quite expensive.
Is it a liquid? Or?
Yeah, it's liquid. And you get it with added zinc and without zinc and stuff. There's about several different versions of it.
Mm-hmm.
So you could try that because our kids swear by it.
How often do they have it? Is it
whenever they get a cough or a cold coming
on. They feel something's coming on.
Yeah, and then it's usually gone in a couple of days.
Oh, that's really good.
So it does seem to work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Drinks, kids! I might put some chocolate because there's millions of bloody chocolate. Do you just want
to
drink
this,
Campbell?
No, it's alright.
Have you seen it here, Andrew?
Yeah, well, I went in last time, I think, or the time before. I've definitely seen here once before. Definitely. All your stuff in here because you got this from a borstal or something, didn't you? Where was that? You found that in an old row from the school, wasn't it?
This is in the school up in the base. Oh, the base is so cool. Here's Pennywise.
That's Pennywise, right? Yeah. I'm recognised from the Facebook postings, but.
Didn't
know
much new in her
though.
Mm. Did you see my Planet of the Apes astronaut?
Oh, excuse me. I don't know where. No, I don't think
Can
I did see that.
It? It's so cool.
I don't think I did see that. Maybe I did, maybe I didn't, but I can't remember it, so I'll look at it again. Oh, wait, no, maybe I didn't see it then.
Kids, are you being good?
They're downstairs now, I think. Oh, no, they're not. They're up here somewhere.
Here. Isn't it cool?
Oh, wow. When did you get that? That's huge.
A while ago, in summer. Brilliant, isn't it? Look at Lubin.
That's massive. That's bigger than life-size, that, isn't it?
I know, he's taller than me.
Hello, Lubin.
Yummy.
There's nothing quite so calming as seeing a cat sleeping on a bed.
I know. What? They're gorgeous. And they're so soft, and they just smell... Yeah, they're really calming to be around, aren't they?
Yeah.
If you're feeling pissed off about something, it's really nice.
The absolute best thing is when they jump on your lap, though.
Yeah.
Because when Mitzi does that.
Does your cat dribble on you?
Not usually. She's not a dribbler. Whiskers did a little bit, but
yeah.
She's not. Mitzi's not a dribbler in any way that
because,
I've noticed.
Lugan does it loads. Willoughby does it loads. Whisker doesn't do it so much. She's not really a dribbling thing.
Was that at Planet of the Apes in a particular film, then, the astronaut one? Was it from, or was it just a, you know...
I think it was. I'm not really up for all the Planet of the Apes films.
Right. No, not really. I mean, I know some of them. I know the, the first one.
Yeah.
Particularly, that's the best one. But I've watched most of them at one time or another.
Yeah, there was a bunch of them, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was about, I think, 4 or 5.
Yeah.
But the last one was...
They've remade
it with Helena Bonham Carter, didn't they? She was in it.
Yeah, about...
Which was about 10, probably 8 or 9 years ago now.
Yeah.
And then they had another remake, didn't they?
He's got a beard. I've got a tiny...
I can
feel
it.
I've got a tiny beard. I've got a really tiny beard.
You've got a tiny beard?
You can't see it, but you can...
As long as it's not to go with your tiny eyes.
Tiny eyes.
Like two tiny butterbees.
They come out with some stuff, don't they?
Yeah, they must have a right laugh.
Tiny hands.
Tiny hands.
I was playing one of those Smell of Reeves and Morton to Isaac. I downloaded them. And I'd forgotten about the Mr. Papa, Monsieur Papa, Mr. What the, I can't remember the name of them, but the two French guys where Vic's got the very thick glasses on, you know, and they walk along and they just start farting, you know. It just creases me up so much. It creases me up so much. But we still, I've downloaded some of these and we've only watched about two of them. I keep trying to get Isaac to watch them with me. But we're always doing something else, you know. Yes, Amanda showed me. That's good, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
Sadie is your
Kirk Douglas.
Spelt wrong.
Sadie, rubber is a sputter and you can get fast.
You're full of wet beans tonight, Silas. I don't remember you being like this last time I was here.
Rumpusing going on.
We'll have to march you through the woods in the dark, I think.
Hello?
Yes.
We're going to look at me. We're losing our energy by having exercise.
What's his daddy and Andrew?
Daddy and Andrew.
Oh, thank you so much.
Did you watch the IT crowd?
I watched a couple of few of those and it was very funny, yeah. Yeah, I should watch some more of those.
Really, just so well written. We've got several of those.
Have you?
Yeah.
Guys. Yeah, I think I've watched. I think I've watched one. How many series were there? About three or four. Yeah. I've watched two of them.
Yeah.
I think no one series I've watched
of them. It's just it got better and better and better.
Yeah, I'll have to watch that again. Actually, yeah. It's if you've got a slightly nerdy humour, it's even more appealing.
Have one.
Thank you so much. But the guy who's in that, the guy with the frizzy hair, he's written a book or something fairly recently, hasn't he?
Richard Ayoade.
Yeah, he's really cool. I love his voice.
And he was interviewed on Channel 4 and talking about how he doesn't like to be interviewed. And he did a really unusual interview as well. So I just ended up stumbling across that randomly. I wasn't really looking for it. And I forget what he was saying, but it was one of these he was saying, well, I don't really like to be interviewed and let's talk about something else. He kept changing the subjects and stuff deliberately.
Oh, a bit like the Mighty Boosh guy. What's his name?
Julian Barrett,
very awkward.
All right.
The other showman, Jonathan Ross. But I think Jonathan Ross was rubbing it up the wrong way, so it didn't help. But Noel Fielding's more that kind of person, isn't he? Who can do all that being interviewed.
Noel Fielding.
Have you seen The Mighty Boosh?
And then I never watched it.
Very good. Have you ever seen Flight of the Conchords?
No.
That's so clever. So funny.
Was it Flight of the Condors or Flight of the Concords? Concords.
Yeah, two New Zealand living in
America,
living in New York. And they're a group, aren't they? They're a group. They're sort of, they're in a band, the Concords, Flight of the Concords.
They've got this manager that's really a New Zealand guy that works at the embassy and manages them part-time, doesn't he?
I think I might have possibly. The name's fairly familiar now you've described it. I don't think I've ever watched it.
Oh, it's such a clever comedy. Really clever.
There's none left
and
now.
You know, because they do all little songs and that throughout the.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've seen some of that. I do remember what. I think I maybe watched one of them, but. I suppose I did. Again, I probably didn't quite get into
it
at first.
It's one of those things that you know it's best to watch from the beginning, so you get their story and you know what was going on with them.
Dada.
Like the manager.
Right.
They've got one fan who follows it. He's absolutely obsessed with them.
One obsessed fan.
One fan. So, there's another thing that's just so well written.
The songs are very cool.
The songs are brilliant. The songs are
year 2000.
Well done.
Distant future.
Yeah, it's so cool. That's hilarious. So really, just so cleverly done. It's a shame they're not making any more. There are rumours of making a third series, but I'm not going to.
It's a bit like, I think sometimes though, if they only do like 12 episodes, it's a bit like Fawlty Towers, isn't it? They only ever made 12 of those, and they only ever made, what was the other one I thought of just then? There's another comedy series that they only made 12 of. The young ones.
You know, the hotel, the exterior,
yes.
That was down the road.
Oh, was it really? Yeah. I didn't realise it was here.
Down.
Oh yeah, I knew it burned down.
It was right next to where Mum worked,
wasn't
it?
Oh, was it?
It's like 10 minutes down the road, but it's burnt down. So
yeah, I'd heard it.
Really.
Yeah.
It could have been tourist attraction.
Yeah.
They had it as a club called Fawlty Towers after the Fawlty Towers.
Oh, did they?
Because it's Reuben Grange, it's what its real name was.
And was it, was really a hotel or was it something
it was
else?
A club type place, I think, okay. And other people could go in the evening. Flowery twats.
Fawlty Towels.
In feel like that there were loads and loads and loads and loads of episodes. But
yeah,
like
only 12.
No,
yeah.
No, you have two. Yeah. No, you have
brilliant,
four.
That.
You want it or you want it?
Well, I've had enough. I've had two rich chocolates, thank you.
Grandma likes orange creams, doesn't she?
No.
Is that an orange cream?
I love chocolate.
I've had plenty, thank you.
Who's that doing it out,
Lizzie? Oh, just...
Errol Flynn.
Who really wants it except me?
Errol Flynn, North Vancouver, visit 2.
And I want to see. Can I?
He was a movie star.
Which one?
Errol Flynn.
He was.
Careful, look where you go.
He played some swashbuckling heroes, I think. Or did
Robin
he?
Hood
Robin Hood. Did he play Zorro as well? Sorry, which one?
Pirates.
Yeah.
Something, wasn't it? I can't remember the name of it.
He wasn't in something like some version of Treasure Island, was he, or something? Or was that something? No, he probably wasn't in that, was he? Still beans. Bouncy man. Stretcher man. Made of rubber.
We need to make you a little circuit. That's a shame we've blocked this door.
Look how tall I am.
You're very tall, aren't you? You're very tall for your height, aren't you?
I can go up and down. Up, down.
That's very good.
Okay. I think I'm 5'10½", I think.
Oh, you're the tallest in half.
Or maybe, possibly right. 5'11". But, yeah.
I'm not high.
I'm a 6 foot tall ape descendant.
How tall are you, Dad?
5'9".
I used to know that off by heart.
5'9" is 19.
When I was a kid, TV version. Didn't I?
Yes.
We used to drive Grandpa insane by the
way. Ill in bed upstairs listening to the hitchhikers over and over and over again.
a cool thing for like a 5-year-old kid to be.
There's not that many girls that are interested in hitchhikers, really. Not in my experience. Only a few.
Oh, I was crazy about this.
Wow. Zoe was as well.
Yeah. I don't know why anyone would have been to that. It's so incredible. The TV version was perfect. Just everything about it's wonderful. Casting,
what that,
visuals.
What the fuck am I
It's just pure magic. Pure magic TV, that was. Another thing I loved,
Dave Triffitt's
TV version. Came out some time as well. Very good, yeah.
Oh,
maybe 80, 81.
Four.
That was 15. Crazy about watching that as well.
14.
Do you remember
the Box of Delights? It was a kid's thing that was on.
Vaguely. I remember the name.
It had
Did it?
Oh, and it was on at Christmas. Run up to Christmas, and then the last episode was on Christmas Eve. And it was all set around Christmas time in the 1930s. And it was just so brilliant, wasn't it? Well, I still watch it every Christmas.
Do you?
Yeah, before Christmas. We've got the DVD and I'll put it on. It's brilliant. The kids saw it when they're younger. I might be able to watch it again, actually, because they'll really enjoy that. But I love, you know, BBC used to make some great films. They used to make good stuff for kids. They don't do that much now.
I'm the oldest kid in this house.
You are the oldest
kid. Oh, yeah, I'm the littlest.
Shall I carry on with this, then, you think? Shall I carry on? Right. Well, I'd put into this some of the what some of the astronauts have said about the topic known as disclosure. And I talked before about Buzz Aldrin. I talked about him. Well, I keep thinking you were there last week, but you weren't. I mentioned him last week. I've talked about Edgar Mitchell before, which you might have heard me speak about. Gordon Cooper. And they're all very interesting for different reasons. And other astronauts have also made comments, notably the late Dr. Brian O'Leary and Story Musgrave. He also made comments about them seeing various things. But the famous statement by Neil Armstrong, which I don't know if I've got a recording. Let's just see. There we go. Oh, you've probably heard me play this before.
With us, a group of students, among America's best. To you, we say, we've only completed a beginning. We leave you much that is undone. There are great ideas undiscovered, breakthroughs available to those who can remove one of truth's protective layers.
So what was Armstrong on about? Truth's protective layers? What was he talking about? That was in 1994, the same year that Aldrin's marriage of 38 years broke up. So I get the feeling he thought he might try and disclose something then, but was probably warned off. So what about Buzz Aldrin? Well, if you want to watch the documentary, I think we've probably spoken about this, Astronauts Gone Wild, you'll see him saying to Bart Sobrell, if you show this publicly, I'm going to start a lawsuit. So Bart Sobrell showed it publicly, their interview, but I don't think Aldrin ever started a lawsuit because he knew he would have lost, probably.
About 3 days and 200,000 miles into the flight, Mission Control did miss the significance of a cryptic message from the astronauts. The crew required information on the current position of the S4B, the final stage of the rocket, which had been jettisoned away 2 days earlier. This short message hid an extraordinary turn of events. Apollo 11 wasn't alone in space.
There is something out there that was close enough to be observed, and what could it be?
Travelling alongside Apollo 11 was a mysterious object, like this one filmed on a later mission. If the object wasn't part of Apollo's rocket, it could be only one thing. a UFO.
Mike decided he thought he could see it in the telescope, and he was able to do that. And when it was in one position, it had a series of ellipses. But when you made it real sharp, it was sort of L-shaped. That didn't tell us very much.
NASA knew very little about the object reported by the Apollo 11 crew. It was obviously an unidentified flying object, but such objects were not uncommon, and the history of even Earth orbit space flights going back over the previous years indicated that several crews saw objects.
Despite having a clear view of the UFO, the crew were wary of reporting it to mission control.
Now, obviously, the three of us were not going to blurt out, "Hey, Houston, we got something moving alongside of us, and we don't know what it is. You know, can you tell us what it is?" We weren't about to do that, because we know that those transmissions would be heard by all sorts of people, and who knows what somebody would have demanded that we turn back because of aliens or whatever the reason is. So we didn't do that, but we did decide we just cautiously ask Houston, where, how far away was the S4B?
Unaware of the drama unfolding in space, Mission Control radioed the position back to Apollo 11.
Apollo 11, Houston, the S4B is about 6,000 nautical miles from you now, over.
And a few moments later, well, they came back and said something like it was 6,000 miles away because of the maneuver. So we really didn't think we were looking at something that far away. So we decided that after a while of watching it, it was time to go to sleep and not to talk about it anymore until we came back and debriefing.
To this day, whatever it was the crew saw has never been positively identified or officially acknowledged.
The possibility that you might encounter aliens in space has to be considered in a very sensible and positive and realistic way. There are a lot of people within the program who went off later and became convinced that UFOs existed. And that led to some concern on NASA's part, where they got the agreement of the crew never to publicly talk about these things for fear of ridicule.
I have been always interested in extraterrestrial life, and I don't know if it's true or not, but I had heard that someone was saying that you had seen a UFO. NASA said, "Don't say anything about it. We might as well get it from a horse's mouth, Buzz. Did you see anything unusual up there?"
Well, you know, a guy by the name of Charles Berlitz wrote something about the Roswell incident, and to establish his credibility, he had a little table in the front of his book which attempted to take advantage of alleged observations of people, of unusual sightings. And he specifically referred to Anglia TV's reported this, that had been cited by somebody else, that Neil and I saw some green things, green creatures. Well, this kind of spoiled my credibility and a lot of other people, so I decided to take him to court and sue him because he was repeating phrases that were inaccurate. He's not done the right kind of thing. Well, we won the suit. And I, you know, hopefully it would cause a few people to be a little bit more careful in how they try and treat trusted servants of our government and of our people to tell the truth. I just feel that it's a little irresponsible of people to, especially after so many years, to bring up subjects that that have been explained rather thoroughly, especially in our case in debriefings.
Oh. with their habitation. We can keep track. If there's something very important to be developed from the moon, I'm not sure what it is right now. And I sure think we should identify what it is for America to make such gross expenditures again for human habitation on the moon. We can help. We can join with. Together, we can explore the moon and develop the moon. We should go boldly where man has not gone before. Fly by the comets, visit asteroids, visit the moon of Mars. There's a monolith there, a very unusual structure on this little potato-shaped object that goes around Mars once in 7 hours. When people find out about that, they're going to say, who put that there? Who put that there? Well, the universe put it there. If you choose, God put it there.
Somebody's been bumped or something.
Yeah, I don't know. Could be something simple as they thought a dog.
Or maybe just...
they quite often get freaked out like that.
So all that, why I was playing that clip, is it's clear that Aldrin's story, you can't get his story straight. He tells a big long story about the S4B thing, which he saw in space, but yet when he talks to George Nuria, which was a few months later... He doesn't even mention it. He talks about somebody saying, oh, somebody tried to say he'd seen little green men.
Yeah. Which obviously isn't what George knew he was talking about.
No.
He must have heard him talking about the thing.
The booster,
trailing them.
So why didn't he say, well, actually we thought, you know, it was a UFO, but actually it turned out to be the booster or something. I know he didn't say that in the video clip, but what he said was nothing like what he said in the documentary, which... So this is inconsistent behaviour. Yeah, Charles Berlitz.
Talking about aliens or something. He didn't, you know. Yeah, that is just odd, isn't it?
So, that you know, this is where you start looking into the astronauts themselves and they can't get their story straight. And not only on this stuff, but on the Apollo stuff itself. You know, so...
Consistency in when they're interviewed.
Well, not about this sort of stuff. And then there's all these stories of, you know, of Armstrong being on the moon and them seeing... things on the rim of the crater and then being told. But that's all disinformation from what I can work out, because if you try and find out when those statements were made and who recorded them or get recordings of them, you can't. You know, there's no recordings of those statements, and it's meant to be some radio ham, some anonymous radio ham that picked up these messages where they were listening.
You know, like those stories of the World Trade Center about it being closed off from 3 a.m. and nobody allowed in.
Are they all right?
They locked themselves in the bathroom.
How did they manage
that? I don't know. I think they locked it for some weird
reason. But how did you unlock it?
The science unlocked
it. Through it. You had to talk. What? Explain what happened.
I locked the door because we didn't want any monster or something to come in while Cyrus is having a toilet. And then when you finished, I unlocked it. I tried to open the door, but I couldn't, and I kept crying for help.
Well, wouldn't you have a better idea and turn it that way?
Yeah, you did, didn't you?
If it wouldn't go,
finally Silas unlocked it, and Dad was here.
All I was saying when you were out of the room was that clip of Aldrin that I showed, it was inconsistent. In other words, he told the story of the S4B thing that they saw, or what might have been the S4B, on that TV documentary. That was on Channel 5 or Channel 4 or something. And then on George Nuri's show, he said, oh, we talked about this.
Which
somebody...
is Coast to Coast is kind of alternative.
Yeah, so that's the safe place. Stuff. That's the safe place to talk about UFO
really
stuff. And he didn't even talk about that story.
Yeah.
So I was just showing people, by showing that clip, that their stories, and they can't get the stories straight, you know.
Inconsistent.
Yeah, inconsistent.
What about that Noetics one? What's his name?
This is him.
Oh, you're coming up to him.
This is him.
If you're going to press me on this, I'm not going to talk to you anymore, because I won't pursue this. All of this attempt to say the Apollo programs were fake is just sheer nonsense. And you can talk till hell freezes over, and you're wrong.
Okay. Well, would you...
I won't continue on this line.
Would you swear on the Bible that you walked on the moon?
You bet your sweet ass.
Okay, put your left hand on the Bible. Put your left hand on the Bible. Raise your right hand. And say, I, Edgar Mitchell.
I, Edgar Mitchell.
Affirm.
Affirm.
Under penalty of eternal damnation.
I don't believe in that, but...
Under,
if you didn't think of eternal damnation.
Then I walked on the moon on Apollo 14.
Then I walked on the moon on Apollo 14.
Well, you know, you're the first astronaut to do that. We asked six other astronauts to swear on the Bible, and they refused to do it.
So it doesn't matter what you said.
I don't particularly like to take oaths like that either, because I don't accept the Bible as the gospel of anything except a historical record. But we did go to the moon. Okay, turn off the camera. Your interview is done. I've given you all the time I'm going to give you.
Okie dokie. Good to meet you.
I don't say it's a pleasure.
Understand.
Please get your ass out of my house.
Okay.
And you came here under false pretenses. And I think you're an asshole.
Gets better.
Well, and if you continue this, and if you press this, I will personally take you to court.
I hope that you do. I invite you to. I'm going to give you my card so you can arrange that. And I'm encouraging you to arrange...
You're frankly not worth it.
No. We have you on the record saying you'll take me to court. I hope you do. Because we have proof that would prove it in a court of law that Apollo 11 didn't go to the moon. And I think it's something that you should see. I don't say that lightly, believe me. I don't say it lightly.
You're not joking, sir. People can have fun. And maybe do that if they feel like they want to have a little fun on a trip to the moon. As an independent producer,
we're heading out.
Doing that is against moral ethics.
Lying about going to the moon is a satanic lie of gigantic proportions.
I don't get people, but you're going to be on the deck unless you go.
I'm heading out. I appreciate it.
And get the hell out of my house. You'll get a gun and shoot them at them before they get out of the office.
We have a video camera running if you want to do it.
Right.
Right, that would be great footage for us. See you later. In court, I hope.
You want to call the CIA? Have them wax.
And one good feeling.
Until the current period, or until it lasts 3 years. It was conventional wisdom, both in science and theology. We're alone in the universe, the single repository of life, anywhere in the known universe. Well, no one believes that anymore. Well, if the accounts are to be believed, yes, there have been ET visitation, there have been crashed craft, there have been material and bodies recovered, and there is some group of people somewhere that may or may not be associated with government at this point, but certainly were at one time, that had this knowledge.
Joined by a distinguished American in West Palm Beach, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo 14 astronaut, sixth man to walk on the moon. Many of the Roswell witnesses told Dr. Mitchell their accounts, which he says were later verified by a contact at the Pentagon. What do you believe, Dr. Mitchell?
Well, I can say, Larry, I have no first-hand experience, but all of my experience comes from what I call the old-timers that at some point in their, before they passed on, and these were folks all gone now, and because I was who I was, because I lived in the area, I grew up in the area, and because I was an astronaut, some of them wanted to get it off their chest before they passed on, and I happened to be selected to hear their story. Mm. And all of them, as I heard some of the earlier testimony, all of them were under very severe oaths and fear and penalty for talking. But they didn't have to talk. I happen to have lived in the area, and I grew up in the area, and my family had farming and ranch holdings and farm machinery holdings. We knew many of the people, including the ranch where this was discovered, and in spite of all of the security oaths, etc., the talk in the community was of what it was, that it was a alien craft, And that survived all of the other stories and all of the other oaths and so forth. It was there for a long time. I happen to have lived there. As a matter of fact, Robert Goddard, father of American rocketry, his farm was right down the road from ours, and I walked past his home every day going there. So I feel fairly well informed on all of this. And like some of your earlier witnesses, Larry, whose fathers talked to them or whose parents talked to them, and they were involved, we heard the same thing. We knew it. It was not really covered up. And so these stories did get out, even though the day after the official announcement had come out in the Roswell Record in the newspaper and was repeated the next day, there was a lot of whispering and laughing going on about what in the world's going on. One of the pivotal people that I encountered early in my career was Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut.
Edgar J. Mitchell, Apollo mission astronaut, founded the Noetics Institute in Southern California. The Institute's charter was supposedly to develop alternative energy systems by attracting inventors from all over the country. Mitchell became extremely interested in De Palma's end machine. He made De Palma a paltry offer to buy out the invention, which De Palma naturally refused. He said to me that if I ever tried anything on my own in California, I would get my head blown off. So I was scared to death. The CIA operates through various very innocent-looking fronts to find out what people are thinking and what they're inventing. Now, what's more innocent than the denying institute founded on transcendental principles to help new age inventors bring free energy into the world?
Oh dear, it's a nasty cough. So that he goes into a lot more detail on his website, Bruce De Palma, about that incident and how Mitchell wanted to. De Palma's dead, he died in 1997. Allegedly, he suicide. And he was allegedly a drug user and an alcoholic. Allegedly. Probably. So, but I wrote an article out. I mean, when we were at Plumforth, I put, you know, those articles out. The Edgar Mitchell article, because Gary had had a glowing article, or not a glowing article, but he'd had an article in his magazine about that free group that Mary Rodwell's associated with, because Edgar Mitchell's on the board of advisors for that free group.
What free group?
It's the, forget what the acronym stands for, but it's to do with contactees. It's to do with contactees.
So, Edgar Mitchell is
Edgar Mitchell is basically, I think, fulfilling two roles. One is to, you know, be a magnet that people come to that are interested in this stuff and see him as a credible figure. And the other is to put out disinformation, which is what he's doing.
What disinformation?
Pardon?
What disinformation is he putting out?
Well, for example, he won't talk about the NASA UFOs themselves, like the ones that were observed in the Tether incident. He won't talk about that. He won't talk about the Tether incident, even though it happened on STS-75, a NASA shuttle mission. I've got another video clip about that. I don't know if I've got it here, but... in this interview in 1996, which I put this in the article as well that I posted more recently, this came from Richard Hoagland's website, actually, because Richard Hoagland was involved in this interview. Edgar Mitchell said, when people ask me, what did it feel like to be on the moon, being a super rationalist and a PhD and all of that, I didn't think it was a germane question. Germane means relevant. He didn't think it was a, you know, question that was worth answering. And then he said later on, should I know what it felt like on the moon? So I went to some good friends of mine, Dr. Jane Houston and her husband Bob Master, and I said, help me find out what I felt like on the moon.
What?
That's what he said in this interview. And that began the investigation of inner experiences for me back in 1972 and led to the approaches that I have taken in the understanding of experience, understanding experience and the psychic experience and all this whole subject matter. But he said in a documentary which was made in 2013 that he worked for the CIA. In relation, he was investigating Uri Geller, and then he had a meeting with George Bush about Uri Geller and Uri Geller's abilities. He said that in that documentary, it's called The Secret Life of Uri Geller, which, yeah, if you haven't seen it, I recommend you watch it. It's 90 minutes long.
Yeah, we should see that.
It's very interesting. Because it does think it's on Vimeo. If you go to Yuri Geller's website, he's got a link to it, and you just put in a password, and you can put in the full version.
Article,
no, he's not. He's probably a trickster.
Why was he being investigated?
Well, he was part of some psychological operation, I think, a bigger psychological operation related to psychic phenomena. I think maybe he did have some kind of ability, but maybe not quite what was being claimed. But he admits he did work for Mossad pretty much in that documentary. Geller more or less admits that. He doesn't use those words, but if you watch the documentary, you'll realise he was heavily involved in working for the intelligence agencies.
Who would you say is genuine?
One person that comes to mind is Matthew Manning, if you've ever heard of him. I also think Colin Fry was genuine as well, but he died, didn't he, quite recently?
Yeah.
Sadly. So Mitchell's been involved in the CIA work, as Bruce De Palma said, that they operate through various innocent-looking fronts like Noetic Sciences. And if you look on their website, they've got a trademark. It says Institute of Noetic Sciences, brackets TM, trademark, on their website. Why do they need a trademark? For, you know, consciousness, enlightenment and all of that stuff, you know. Hey-ho. So I've played that clip again. Let's see.
In 1965, Gordon Cooper was the last American astronaut to go up into space alone. He orbited the planet 22 times.
I think those of you that know me know that I've always spoken honestly and straightforward to you. I can't do so today.
10 years earlier, while stationed at Edwards Air Force Base, Cooper witnessed an event that has yet to be explained nearly 50 years later. He was supervising the filming of a precision landing facility for F-86 fighter jets. Suddenly, a saucer-like craft flew directly over the cameraman. Three landing gear apparatus opened, and the object landed on the dry lake bed.
They're just typical saucer shape, double lenticular shape, metallic. And they went out, picked up their cameras, and moved on out toward him, filming. And he lifted off, put the gear back in the well, and climbed out at a very high rate of speed and disappeared.
Cooper had the film footage of the strange craft developed. By the time it returned from processing, he had gone up through the ranks to report the incident.
Anyway, the colonel telling me to, when the film arrived at my desk, to put it in the carrier pouch. There would be a courier there at my office by that time already, and they'd arrange for him to fly in our base airplane back to Washington with what he was found.
Did he watch the film?
We didn't have a chance to run it. I had a chance to hold it up to the window and look at it. It was certainly a good film.
After the developed film was sent by plane to Washington, it was never seen or heard of again.
Did you ever keep in touch with anybody about it?
How would I keep in touch with anybody about it? There's no way within the military or within the government of keeping track of something that is classified unless you're directly involved in it, and I was not.
So there you go. He saw the object landing and they filmed it. Was he making that up? You know, you're not an audience of sceptics, so you know what I'm at. So Aldrin is flip-flopped and he's switched between apparent disclosure and denial. Mitchell is adopting limited hangouts, stating he knows or knew unnamed sources who told him stuff and he believes that, but he denies NASA's own video footage shows intelligently controlled objects. I didn't show that clip, but I've got that clip elsewhere. That's when David Sarita wrote to him. I wrote about that in the article that I've got on my website as well. I did a transcript of, or got the transcript of David Sarita's letters. Cooper's disclosures seem to get greater and greater over the years, and his disclosure of seeing a film of a landing coming only 1 or 2 years before he died. Actually, that story, I got that wrong. He started telling that story in about 1997, I think was the first time he told that publicly. I found an earlier clip. Cooper was dropped from the Apollo program in favour of Alan Shepard, though he was scheduled to head up the Mars program, according to a 1996 interview with Michael Lindemann. But I think they dropped Cooper from the Apollo program because he was more honest. He would have been more difficult to control than the other guys. I think that's probably why, one of the reasons why they dropped him. And then, of course, we go on to Travis. Let's see, hang on.
That's a good quote.
Yeah, that's what he said. I think that's in his book.
Just after sunset, on the evening of November 5th, 1975, a seven-man crew was piling in...
This is from 1978, from an LP.
...cutting near the tiny northern Arizona community of Snowflake. One of the seven men was Travis Walton, whose curiosity that night plunged him into a living nightmare he would never forget. Just before leaving the work area, the men in the Jeep watched a glowing object emerge from behind the trees. Travis opened a door to get a better view and continued watching, stunned with his companions.
The thing was about 90 feet away, about 20 feet in diameter, about 8 feet high. It was glowing a golden color, kind of like molten metal. Couldn't hear anything at first, and it must have been because when I got closer, I could hear it, but... it was a high-pitched, intermittent sound, and a low rumbling sound. It sounded like machinery, or, you know, a heavy mechanical sound. Very difficult to describe.
Travis got out of the vehicle and moved toward the object, despite cries from his friends for him to return. Walton assumed by the time he could get any closer, the object would be gone.
Just as I got up close, it started to move with a sort of a rocking motion, kind of like a spinning top, you know, like when it's slowing down to fall over, except it wasn't spinning, it, the same side stayed toward me. And when it started to move, it got real loud, and that really scared me, and I jumped down behind a log, and I looked up at this thing, and I decided then I was in a lot of danger, and I was going to get the heck out of there. And I raised up to go. It's the last thing I remember. I raised up and I started to turn. And I was just about in a high crouch when wham, I felt a numbing shock hit me. Kind of like in the head. And I went out. I was knocked unconscious.
His six co-workers, however, saw what Travis had not. A slender beam of intense light which shot from the craft and lifted Walton off his feet, knocking him to the ground. The rest of the crew sped away in panic, looking back to see the craft take off. But when they returned to see if Travis was all right, he was nowhere to be found. When Travis finally came to, he was weak, groggy, and in pain. Above him was a light. He assumed he was in a hospital bed, but as his blurred vision became clearer, he discovered he was wrong.
I felt something pressing on my chest. My shirt and my jacket pushed up, and there was this thing laying across it. It was about 4 or 5 inches thick. The thing extended down over my rib cage and down to my belt. And when I looked up, I saw this thing. It was gray. And I looked past the edge of it, and I saw something white. My eyes weren't focusing. Again, at first I thought it was a doctor, you know, white mask and cap. But when I got to where I could see, I saw this thing, and I just came unglued. I looked around, and there was three of them. I just panicked and became hysterical.
As his eyes became accustomed to the surroundings, Travis saw his captors in more detail.
They were about 4 feet 10. Very large heads. No hair on their heads. No eyebrows, no whiskers or anything like that. They had very large eyes. Those eyes are something that really bothered me more, worse than anything. The rest of their features are small. It was like small ears, small nose, small mouth, or hardly any lips if they had any lips. saw them open their mouth. But they were wearing a long coverall type thing. They were orangish tan. When I saw them, I struck out. It wasn't really a blow. I was so weak. I pushed this one on my right, and he fell back into another one. But they felt kind of marshmallow, kind of like fat, you know. Whereas, you know, when you push against somebody with muscle, it feels differently. But they seemed light, unexpectedly. And I jumped off the table there and staggered over into the corner. There was a bench across the wall. I leaned there. I was really weak, and I was so scared, you know, I was shaking, and they started towards me. And I started just screaming now, you know, telling them to keep away from me. And I reached over and I grabbed a thing off of the table. There was a bunch of things there, and there was a clear tube about maybe an inch in diameter, I don't know, a foot and a half long. And I thought, it wasn't heavy like glass, it was too light for a club, so I wanted to defend myself. And so I hit it against the table to break it and maybe get a sharp point, but it didn't break. But I lashed out at him with it. And I kept screaming, it only took a couple of steps, and they stopped.
After the creature departed, Travis left the room through the same door, but went down the hallway in the opposite direction.
I came to a doorway on my right, and I went into this, I didn't go right in, I looked in, and it was a round room, a domed room, with a chair in the middle. And it was really funny about this room, it was really strange. It looked like, you know, I could see the walls and the same as there were everything else in the place. It was all just this matte gray metal look. But when I went towards the chair, I didn't go towards the chair right away. I walked around towards the side because the chair was high backed and I was afraid that there might be one of those things sitting in that chair. So I went around there. When I could see that there was nobody in the chair, I walked over to it. But the closer I got to the chair, the darker the room seemed. And I could start seeing points of light, like the stars. There was buttons there. You know, I did a stupid thing. I pushed some, hoping to open the door or something. But when it didn't work, well, I got scared of doing that too, because it made the stars move. I turned, and there was a man standing in the doorway came through. And this guy, I mean, he appeared human to me. You know, which was a big relief. And I ran up there and started asking all kinds of questions. And just smiled, kind of tolerant-like. And I assumed that maybe he couldn't hear me because he had the helmet on. A clear helmet. And so when he motioned for me, and he took me by the arm, I went with him. I assumed that I was being rescued.
Travis was led out of the craft and into a large hangar, where more human-like figures were present. He remembers their appearance this way.
They passed, you know, on the street, but they had a strange thing to their eyes. It were a light color, a golden hazel, you know? And they had a resemblance to each other, like a family, but not identical. There was one of them that was a woman, and I could tell. Had longer hair, female shape. One of the men and the woman came over there and they put me on the table and they put a mask over my face and I started to resist and they held me on the table and they put this mask on my face and I reached up to pull it away and before I could, everything went black.
Meanwhile, the other members of the woodcutting crew had reported Walton missing. Local police organized the search party, but no trace of Walton was found. The next thing he remembered, Travis was lying on the side of a road outside Heber, Arizona, 12 miles from Snowflake.
When I first regained consciousness, I was laying on the roadway, well, to the side of the road, more off than on, and my head was on my arm, and I saw a light, and I looked up in time to see it go off, which I think was either a light going off or a hatch closing, perhaps. Then I saw that this object hovering there It was a flattened sphere. I mean, it was shaped like a disc, but it was very shiny, comb-like. I could see that reflecting everything around there, but not giving off any light. It was dark. It was just there for a second, hovering about 4 feet off the ground, and it just shot straight up. It was incredible how quick, without making a sound.
Travis staggered to a phone booth to call his family, who at first did not believe it was really him. But once convinced, they came to take him home. On the way, Travis received yet another shock.
We were riding back in, and they said something about everybody being worried about him. I can't remember the exact conversation, but I said, well, you know, it must have been a bad couple of hours or something, to reference the time or something like that. And they said, Travis, you've been gone for 5 days.
While recuperating, Travis was able to remember most of what had happened to him. A series of hypnotic regressions with Dr. James Harder from the University of California, however, enabled Walton to recall things with less anxiety and more detail.
So there you go. That was the story of Travis Walton that he told in 1978. I've got that whole LP on my website.
I was going to say, I only want a copy.
And download it. I'll send you the link later.
Yeah,
it's only about 40 minutes or something. It's pretty good, for the time.
Travis Walton.
No, it's various things. There's an interview with Steven Spielberg as well.
I like the music. Yeah. Music.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah. I thought you'd like that.
What a great find. I bet it's got some great cover artwork too, eh?
I put them in. They're from Travis Walton's website.
So he's had them commissioned from...
Mike Rogers, his brother-in-law, did them.
They're wonderful.
Oh, his brother-in-law, yeah.
Michael Brewer. He does a lot of them. He does a lot of
This is really weird. This is from a few years ago. I mean, what the hell is that? You've seen it, yeah. Did you see the second film of it, though? You'll see that in a minute. This is from another angle. So two people filmed it. This is from, the other direction. So Pedro Hernandez and Alfredo Carrillo, they both filmed it. It's an orb ejecting other orbs. And you'll hear people say there is no clear film. You'll still hear people say that. So I think that I put this in because it was, it had come out about the time I was making this presentation, so I thought it was a good addition. Because, it's an incredible piece of film, that. I still don't think I've seen one as good as that, as weird as that, since then. Yeah, right. So the chances... And I mean, Jaime Maussan himself has been wrapped up in controversy because of that little creature, that they apparently caught, the little sort of creature with the strange teeth. And did you remember seeing that at all? But it turned out to be a monkey, a marmoset monkey, that somebody had faked the skeleton. I don't know if you... Oh, that's the story,
It was attacking.
Yeah, that's right, it was attacking them. So, 2007, 2008, going back a few years, we saw a clear effort to link UFOs to national security. That thing that Edgar Mitchell was on, they started to try and say that the UFOs were coming over nuclear weapons areas. And they interviewed this guy called Dr. Robert Jacobs, who filmed them firing a beam at a nuclear test missile in 1967. And so Robert Jacobs started talking about that story, this nuclear missile test and a UFO coming into the picture in 1982. So he talked about that after 15 years of silence. CNN then started to pick up that story in 2008, which is 26 years later. So how come it took them so long? So that's why I think they have this agenda, you know, as Richard and I have said, to put things out in a certain way at a certain time to suit whatever it is that they want to put out at that time, you know. And then there was a lot of interest in Mitchell. I mean, that happened in 2008, dropped off after that. So why does this happen? But so what I proposed here is that there's at least two threads of disclosure. One thread seems to be that we are to be being controlled by the Western media and is generally fear-based. That is the general, you know, you've probably seen that yourselves. I don't need to tell you that. Either they say the aliens are going to harm us, or they give the impression that things are going to be bad if we know about them, you know. Human abductions, animal mutilations may also be components of a negative disclosure program. And if they've got these secret technologies and they put those in the media every so often and people realise it's something which can't be being done by conventional technology, it's pretty scary, isn't it, to see these animals with eyes gouged out and, you know, it's pretty scary, gruesome, you know, guttural stuff, isn't it? You know, yeah, yeah, yeah. So if they're trying to say, you know, that this is what these aliens could do to us, I mean, you can't get much more scary than that.
I want to be abducted by an alien.
I don't want you to be.
No. I don't want you to be either.
Because, I mean, even if everyone hears these stories, you know.
It's not my
thing. And you might not, like, analyse it, you know, but it sinks into your subconscious.
Yeah, exactly, you know? Exactly.
And when you see something related to it, you go straight to that place to get that kind of response, that sort of fear.
You know, and you have to ask yourself, if they've got this technology to do that kind of thing to animals, why did they just leave them in the field? Why are they just leaving them on the ground? Why aren't, if they really want them for genetic testing or whatever, why don't they take the corpses with them and then, you know, dump them in space, or just use all the tissue for more testing or whatever they need? The fact that they're leaving it there, to me, appears that whoever's doing it, which I don't think is necessarily... aliens, not necessarily. They're leaving it as a calling card. It's a message. Yeah. It's a psychological aspect to it.
Serial killer.
Yeah, I think maybe you're right. Maybe that's what they are doing it. And these other events where we're getting these, I mean, like the Travis Walton case, I think the people that were involved with, you know, the aliens that involved with Travis Walton, I think they were good guys, basically. I don't think they were, you know, he thinks they tried to help him. And you can read his book anyway, he writes a lot more about that.
They brought him back at least.
Yeah, and if you read the book, he's got some thoughts on that whole thing, you know, quite interesting to read. But I think the people who are running Planet Earth, those that did 9/11, are behind the negative disclosure thread. I think that's all the fear-based paradigm and all of that stuff. And that those outside agencies, because I do think Wilbert Smith did have real contact with some consciousness or beings or something, you know, he never met them in physically. I think they're on the positive side. I think they're positive, being they seem to be trying to help him, trying to give him good information. He built stuff, it worked. And I think each person makes a choice as to which side they kind of spend the most time looking at. I think, you know, looking at all these figures, you get some are convinced that all the aliens are really bad guys, you know, and then others who think they're all good, but it seems to be a mixture. And I don't think she'll be blind to ever. I don't think she'll be blind to either thread. But this is what I put at the end of this.
In 1974, after being a sixth grade school teacher, I was introduced to the late Dr. Werner von Braun in the U.S., the father of rocketry. In my first meeting with him during that first 3.5 hours, he said to me, "Carol, you will stop the weaponization of space." And I said, you know, teachers don't stop until June. He said, "No, you have to understand, this is February, and we have to prevent the weaponization of space because there is a lie being told to everyone that the weaponization of space is now first being based upon the evil empire, the Russians. There are many enemies," he said, "against whom we're going to build this space-based weapon system, the first of whom was the Russians, which was existing at that time. Then there would be terrorism. Then there would be terrorism. Then there would be terrorists. Then there would be third world countries, now we call them rogue nations or nations of concern. Then there would be asteroids." And then he would repeat to me over and over, "And the last card the last card. The last card would be the extraterrestrial threat. Well, at the time, I kind of laughed when he said asteroids, and when he said extraterrestrials, I knew I wasn't going to deal with that subject. And now we hear in the news just today, this week, that they've slid in another enemy. Only this time we're going to protect our satellites. In other words, we have to have some reason to spend these trillions, to waste these dollars on a space-based weapon system, and they're all lies.
Look at that.
You look at what comes next.
Good now, I'm not in New York City. That happens in New York City, didn't
it? Yeah, you're right, Silas. It did happen in New York City. Well done for knowing that, because not many 6-year-olds would know that, would they?
Well, yeah, it definitely happened in New York.
And as the witnesses said, it was like a movie. Well, what movie was it like? Maybe it was a bit like Independence Day.
It's just literally turning into dust.
Yeah, it's just literally.
You're right, babies. Aren't they clever, Andrew?
Yeah. Literally it is literally turning into dust.
That one's
I hope you remember that when you get older.
There's like a little
when people tell
rip.
You it's terrorists, you'll know better, won't you?
And then I can see a little rip. Over and over. And the last card, the last card, the last card would be the extraterrestrial threat. And the last card.
So
the last
what?
Card.
What happens when they run out of ISIS's and Osama bin Laden's and
The Stooges?
You know, they just need to spend maybe 10 or 20 years getting rid of the ridicule factor. Which may be what the disclosure movement is now, like Steve Bassett and all those guys. Maybe they're helping to get rid of the ridicule factor for the people to get ready for that. I don't know. It's just I'm just saying be aware of that as a scenario, you know, that they're going to use to manipulate people, potentially. You know, potentially. So, what Wilbur Smith did, going back to him, so I thought this was a good way to end it. The audio is not brilliant, but hopefully you can hear it better on with Matt switched on the sound. Was if you listen to this. So this is about 18 minutes. Oh, go away. Or don't go away. Maybe I'll have to... Oh, heck. It should come on, but let me just try and get it to...
The one in the front, if you ever know, that one in the front is actually...
Right, so let's just do that. This, I don't know why this has been so pernickety, because I've run this, the weird thing is I've run this presentation before. Foo Fighters.
I'm 48 years old, holding a master's degree in electrical engineering, occupy a responsible position in the Canadian government, hold a half dozen patents, author several technical papers, and in general enjoy a background in technical work and science, indicating at least an average competence to study and report on phenomena of magnetic nature. I've tried so far as possible to use conventional and standard methods and equipment and to investigate all possible angles before drawing any conclusions. In other words, I have followed the same general procedures which I would have followed if I had undertaken to study some more prosaic subject, such as radio wave propagation. The first phase of the work consisted of reading all available literature, collecting as much observational
phase involves following up the many and varied needs which developed from the first two phases. I do not intend to dwell on the first phase of this work, as my experience was quite parallel with that of other investigators who have provided extensive published reports of their findings. Nor will I dwell on the many dead ends which were explored, which looked promising at first, but faded out under careful investigation. Nor will I be able to be as specific as I would like to be with respect to material given to me in confidence or which came to me through classified channels. Furthermore, it is not my intention to try and convert anyone to my way of thinking, but merely to state what I believe and why I believe it. Let us look at a few facts. First, hundreds of normal, honest people have seen lights in the sky which behaved like no light normally seen in the sky ought to behave. Second, hundreds of normal, honest people have seen what appear to be solid, real objects in the sky, which behave like no object normally seen in the sky ought to behave. Hundreds of people have seen objects in the earth.
That's Anthony Wood's film. Gone off the thing. I haven't got the video resolution set properly. That's by Paul Potter.
be reflected in the direction and magnitude of the nearby gravity field. There have been quite a number of alleged communications with intelligences claiming to be extraterrestrial. I have followed up each such instance to the best of my ability in an effort to A, establish or disprove the validity of the alleged communication, and B, to obtain any information which might be available if the contact should be authentic. As might be expected, many of these alleged contacts provided little or nothing of value, but a few did pay off. Some of the contacts have been the subject of published material, but by far the majority are confidential, and there are a surprising number of these contacts. The procedure in checking contacts was to ask a number of innocuous but significant questions, and compare the answers with the answers to the same questions as obtained through other contacts. Questions were of the type, do people live on the planet Mars? If so, what is the shape of their houses? Do people on Mars use money? If so, what does it look like? All of the other 100 or more questions were involved. The results were spectacular, to say the least. Among the contacts that might be classed as authentic, there was almost complete agreement. Among the other alleged contacts, there was extremely poor agreement or none at all. Of course, where agreement was general, but one or two points didn't fit, an effort was made to find out why the discrepancy. In each case, it was found that someone had injected a terrestrial idea or comment instead of transmitting faithfully that which was received. Now, having located what seemed to be channels of communication between ourselves and these extraterrestrial intelligences, the next and obvious step was to try and get as much information as possible. As may be expected, this effort was at first directed toward science and technology. But it soon became apparent that there was a very real and quite large gap between this alien science and the science in which I had been trained. Certain crucial experiments were suggested and carried out, and in each case the results confirmed the validity of the alien science. Beyond this, the alien science was just incomprehensible. There followed a period of soul-searching, during which many doubts were raised. While we were able to establish that these people from outside all told the same story, was that story the truth? There existed some pretty good evidence to support their statements, but maybe there was some other more conventional explanation. If the whole thing were a delusion, then quite a large number of people were suffering from precisely the same delusion. And furthermore, delusions are not externalized. At least I have never heard of such a case. If on the other hand it were a hoax, it was by far the most gigantic hoax the world had ever known. And to what end, and by whom was it perpetrated? The inevitable conclusion was that it was all real enough, but that the alien science was definitely alien, and possibly even forever beyond our comprehension. So another approach was tried, the philosophical. And here the answer was found in all its grandeur. I will not go into detail on the many revisions in ideas and basic thinking, beyond stating that the people from outside displayed great patience and understanding in overcoming the prejudices and misinformation I had spent many years in accumulating. I began for the first time in my life to realize the basic oneness of the universe and all that is in it. Science, philosophy, religion, substance, and energy are all facets of the same dual. And before any one facet can be appreciated, the form of the dual itself must be perceived. One of the most important things I had to realize was that we are not alone. lives of these people. Is it any wonder that they are interested in us? To Orthodox thinkers, this may seem strange, but not nearly so strange as our Orthodox ideas on evolution. The question might be asked, if these people are our brothers and are interested in our welfare, why do they remain so aloof? The answer is available. There is a basic law of the universe which grants each and every individual independence and freedom of choice, so that he may experience and learn from his experiences. No one has the right to interfere in the affairs of others. In fact, our Ten Commandments are directives against interference. If we disregard this law, we must suffer the consequences. And a little thought will show that our present world state is directly attributable to violation of this principle. When we enter this life, we do so to participate in certain events, the sequence of which was established before our birth, and which, if altered substantially, would deprive us of experiences necessary to our development. We have built-in protection against altering substantially these sequences in that we do not consciously know of them. But these people from outside have a much greater knowledge than we have and have means of perceiving the sequences which must not be changed. Therefore, while we have every desire in the world to help and stand by, ready, able, and willing to do so, they are not permitted by cosmic law to interfere. The dividing line between help and interference is very delicate indeed, and sometimes hard to perceive. But it is a demonstration of individual and collective progress, how well we can be guided by it. I am told that one of our difficulties is that we do not recognize a sufficient number of dimensions and make use of them in our science. Furthermore, we do not recognize the true nature of dimensions or of their place in our universe. I am told that so far as we are concerned, there are 12 dimensions of deity, and these provide the entire structure of our universe. Our conventional concepts of dimensions are most inadequate and restrictive, and so long as we persist in them, we can never transcend the world of mechanical processes which we have built. In science, we have an established procedure always to tie a new discovery or observation to that which we already know, even though to do so requires extensive patchwork and perturbation factors to be applied to our existing knowledge to make the new knowledge fit. We invariably assume that the new knowledge must somehow be closely related to the old, and we are most zealous in tying the two together. As a consequence, we bend and warp our units of knowledge so that we can fasten them together, whether or not they belong together, until we have fabricated quite a structure which is almost completely closed on itself. Consequently, when we do find knowledge that should, but just won't, fit our structure, we have no alternative but to reject it. I am informed that science really is much more simple than we imagine, and all the component parts fit together perfectly without any corrections. Possibly, we should start over again and reassemble our knowledge in a different pattern, and this time fit the jigsaw puzzle together properly without trimming the pieces. I feel sure that if we were to do this and accept the philosophy upon which this new approach must of necessity be based, we can enjoy the technology and the way of life which is demonstrated to us by the presence of the spacecraft and of our brothers from elsewhere. Thank you.
Who knows? That's the end. And he said, I make no attempt to prove anything and have no intention of doing so. It is up to each and everyone to search out the truth and decide for themselves just what is truth. Truth needs no justification, it stands alone. That's what he said in some of his writings. So you can get all of that on Presidential UFO. Yeah. I've got it on CD. And that's the end.
Wow. That's fantastic.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure and a privilege.
That thing that measures the
binding force.
Was that? Did that come to thousands of UFOs?
I think it was. Are you going to bed now? Night, night, Silas. You have a good sleep. Are you tired now? You must be tired after all that jumping around.
Yeah.
Are you going to have a good rest?
They need something to eat before they go to bed. He's going to bed now.
We haven't had dinner yet. Some cereal? Some toast? I don't know who you eat. Toast, do you?
We had dinner at lunchtime. We had a big meal, didn't we?
We had a big meal.
Snack, really.
Or maybe, so, I don't know.
Toast or cereal?
Cereal, because toast is fiffle-faffle.
Yeah,
fiffle.
But you were very good in that last bit, weren't you? You sat very quietly.
Yeah,
that's
very good.
But we had to shout for help.
Oh, I know, yeah.
Absolutely stuck.
I know.
I'm terrified.
It is terrifying if you can't get out of the room.
Out of the bathroom with Dad, I was shaking. But now I've stopped.
I bet. We heard you screaming. How long were you there? How many minutes?
That's why I said you shouldn't shout and scream in the house, because if something like that does happen, you shout and screaming. Nobody takes any notice.
We don't take any notice because we think you're just being silly. We did say help too.
Yeah, but you say help a lot and don't really mean it. All we heard was this screaming like you two were fighting, like you normally do.